WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much, and welcome. Welcome to the broadcast. Appreciate everyone tuning by. Those of you who are not watching the Oscars, and someone say, "Oh my God, the Oscars are on!" I'm shutting off. Well, they got all the big ones, but we'll tell you as they are awarded. You know, I'm not a big Oscars fan.
No, I'm really not either.
You know, we're in the biz. We're in the general entertainment biz, and it's like folks in the biz are. What are you giving each other awards?
I know. Yeah, for sure.
It doesn't do much for me. But, you know, by now it has gotten to be about the movies themselves, the stars, the glamour. What are they wearing?
And oh, all it's that. What they're wearing for sure.
Yeah. So, I couldn't care less, actually. But
sure, your wife was watching it, though.
She is glued to it, right? So we will bring it to you. Let me see. Well, actually, I did see part of it. I was doing show prep. I was going, past the room where my wife was watching it, and of course, the thing that made me the happiest was Waiting for Sugar Man won the best documentary.
Did it win?
Yeah, about our own Rodriguez, singer.
From Detroit,
Detroit,
It's such an amazing story for people who don't know it, but he grew up, making music, and he was a huge hit in South Africa.
And Australia.
And Australia.
Zero here. He used to play in the Cass Corridor back in the day.
Right.
And he had just kind of become a construction worker.
Right. Did kind of odd jobs and things like that.
Yeah.
living a very simple life. And then this guy decided to do a documentary about him.
Because they couldn't find him.
The people in South Africa were saying, "Where's Sugarman?"
Yeah, and they were, in fact, his music, for some reason or other, Rodriguez's music from Detroit, from the Cass Corridor, became the anthem of the anti-apartheid movement.
It's an amazing story.
And it's not directly, the music isn't directly about apartheid or anything like that.
Yeah.
And
they just somehow connected with that.
Yeah,
him.
They did.
Big time.
And it's an extraordinary documentary.
I haven't even seen it yet, but I'm dying to see it. I've read everything that I can about it, and I just got to go. I got to see it.
And Rodriguez is the most modest guy in the world. I haven't seen him in years. I mean, I know him, but I almost should say I knew him. I haven't seen him in so many years. But we all knew. I mean, he told us that he'd sold a lot of records in South Africa.
And people probably thought he was
crazy.
Him. Some people probably said, whatever.
Yeah, because he's just a guy schlepping around the Cass Corridor. Yeah. With his shades on, he had a big, big old hat and a big long black coat all the time. And
with his guitar strapped to his
back. To his back, yeah. And,
Now he's somehow, he's been on Letterman. I mean, and now he's this documentary about his life.
Won the Academy Award
for
Best Documentary.
And so I think things are probably a little easier for him.
And they've re-released his albums, CBS, I think, or
Sony. He played
Sony.
A gig here. Your wife was telling us that.
He's played a number of gigs.
He played a gig tonight
in
conjunction with the Oscars.
And he's starting to make a lot of money. He said he did not want to, when the director accepted the award for Rodriguez for Waiting for Sugar Man, he said Rodriguez did not want to take it away from the filmmakers.
Right.
Which I only half accept. He is so bashful. I just don't know how he's a performer.
Right. Some people can, they are in a shell and then they're on stage and they come out of that shell. That's definitely me. I'm in such a shell.
Yeah, you have not played publicly in a long time, have you?
You didn't even, that went right over your head.
It must have.
It did.
Okay. I'll review the tape tomorrow.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Rodriguez is making some money. He's lived in the same house for 40 years. And what he does with his money now, he gives it to his family and his friends.
He helps people out who are down and out. So great story. Congratulations.
Yeah. So check it out. I'm sure it'll be one of my favorite, and this is a shameless plug for a friend of mine who runs the Cass City Cinema that's at the corner of Cass and Peterborough in an old school, the Joel Landy, right there in what's called Landy Land.
Yeah, because he's bought a lot of property.
Yeah, but also.
And schools.
But he has created this incredible theater with new seats, digital projection and sound. And
it's amazing.
You can
go
see films like that there. Yeah, if you just look up Cass City Cinema.
I mean, you know, it's one of these schools that shut down, and he bought the school. Not only does he have a movie theater, and I mean, this is just amazing. Yeah. That tour that we took that day was really cool. He's got
I forgot. You were with us.
I was there.
Yeah.
And he has a nursery school there.
Right.
And so kids from the inner city go there. It's a wonderful story.
Hey, by the way, this is Night Call. I'm Peter Werby, and Jalene Jordan, of course, is here as well. Our number, if you'd like to comment, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Always accepting emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/nightcall. My website.
It's acting funny. Yeah.
It's
acting like you can't see anything.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Well, you'll get it straightened out, Peter.
Yeah. And sure. We'll have a podcast up noon on Monday. John is taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's something I'm going to. I'm going to something that is presented by the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship.
What? You?
But it's also co-sponsored by the Windsor Essex County Atheist Society.
Okay, I was going to say.
It's a debate.
Okay.
And it's a debate between Dan Barker, who's the co-president of Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And that's out of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Great guy. He used to be for people, you know, you and I are so used to this stuff. We talk about it, we're like, Dan Barker, oh yeah, Dan Barker. Well, he used to be a minister.
A child minister.
He wrote children's religious music, and he still continues to make money off of it, which he now puts toward his Freedom
Atheism.
From Religion Foundation. And if you want to check it out, it's ffrf.org.
And now he is going to be debating with the Reverend Joe Boot, who is founder of the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity. And I don't think this guy is going to be any pushover. It's a young guy.
Sure he's not.
Young, hip-looking guy. But anyway, this debate is going to be at the University of Windsor CAW Student Center, which, that's interesting, named after the Canadian Auto Workers Union.
Oh!
Yeah, and this is a ways away. It's March 7th at 7 p.m. It's going to be moderated and all of that. And so there are all these people are on board, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the Secular Student Alliance, the Center for Inquiry, but also the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, as well as the Windsor Atheist Society. Now, I hate to tell you this, but Dan Barker, from the president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, he's going to have a hard time.
Because?
Because there's already proof that there's life after death.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
You don't take me seriously.
No. No.
Well, here.
I know you a little too well.
Yeah. I have the New York Times book review section for last week. The number one nonfiction best-selling ebook is Proof of Heaven.
Oh, okay.
By Evan Alexander, a neurosurgeon recounts his near-death experience during a coma from bacterial meningitis.
So what is he? Is it the fluffy clouds and the angels and all that good noise?
Beats the hell out of me. And then the other, my favorite, though, this has been on the bestseller list for 106 weeks. Heaven is for Real, Todd Burpo. A father recounts his 3-year-old son's encounter with Jesus and the angels during an emergency appendectomy.
A 3-year-old? Please. Well, he woke up and said, Daddy.
Guess what I saw?
Okay.
So,
now, I know I've talked to people, and we've heard stories. You've probably heard it from some people who have nearly died on the table. Yeah. And they're, you know, I've heard things like their life passes before their eyes. Things like that. But I've never heard anyone say that they were up there hanging with, you know, JC or anything.
Well, particularly a 3-year-old.
In particular, yes.
But here's what I think. Think about it, what would you say, the cultural specificity.
In other words,
culturally specific. How many people do you think in India or in Africa or in the Middle East?
Yeah.
When they have near-death experiences, see Jesus.
Well,
don't
no,
you think they see,
I don't
they
think
see,
they do.
No, they see Rama or Allah or something like
Muhammad
that.
Muhammad or...
Yeah, exactly. So this is just all about, you know, Western Christian culture.
Yeah.
This is not what, I wouldn't have chosen this because usually in debates, what they have is that it's a resolved. There is life after death, or resolved, there is no life after death.
That's and not going to happen here.
No. I'm talking about the way this is constituted. Is there life after death?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, usually, you know, you could say, you know, resolved, God exists, or resolved, mm-hmm. God does not exist.
Right.
And then one side says yay, and the other side says nay. You
right.
Know, and you each get, and then you get a rebuttal, and it's very formal. I think this is going to be a formal debate. But anyway, it's the Windsor Atheist Society and the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which means they're going to be, if it's fellowship, so go, ho, 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 ho.
You know?
I mean, it's not going to be acrimonious.
God.
You know what I mean? It's not going to be like these right, well, then who knows? I don't know who's going to come in the audience and scream, you're going to burn in hell, you know, like that.
That should be highly entertaining.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Actually, if nobody does it, maybe I'll do it.
Do what?
Just scream, you're going to burn in hell.
Peter, you will not.
No, I won't. 313-298-WRIF. Is there anything important going on? Oh, yeah, I know what I wanted to say. The week before last, I was in California. And I always get an insight into the way I think. Great numbers of the people, maybe even the vast majority of people in this country, relate to the politics that are spinning out.
Out of control.
Out of control, yeah. But are spinning out of the media. And because when I'm not doing show prep, in other words, when I know the most about politics is when we're doing a daily show, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Because
it's concentrated. We were doing 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now we do 2 hours a week.
Yeah. I was doing 3 hours a day and doing
and
2 hours.
This. Yeah, I don't know.
And this. Really was like,
Peter, that's so unlike you.
But I know, being the hardliest working man in show business. Right.
I'm second.
Yeah. But one of the things that I always said to people, you know, that people say, wow, you're lucky. You only work 3 hours
a day. That's a bunch of hooey.
Actually, our boss said that to me. I almost leaped across the desk at him and throttled him for saying that. Because it was what I'm presenting. He said, oh, well, he says, you only work 3 hours a day.
Which boss?
Well, here. I'll.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, you know what I mean. Anyway, so that.
Not from here. This was an old.
Oh, yeah.
That was from when we were syndicated nationally.
Right,
not here at all.
And so.
They dig us here.
Made a lot of money, right? But, man, I will take more leisure anytime.
Yeah, that was a grind, for sure.
But anyway, it was the first thing I thought about.
I was doing more than you. I was doing like 2 air shifts in addition to that.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But I, it was the first thing I thought about when I woke up.
Yes.
And it was the last thing I thought about when I went to sleep.
Yeah.
And I always had a pad of paper by my bedside because if I didn't, I would wake up and start having these kind of rehearsal things, what I was going to say about a certain issue or that, anyway, so I would make notes. So it was, I was like working 24 hours a day.
Do you do that on Sundays now? Do you have your little pad of paper?
I do have a piece of paper there, but it's usually not about show stuff.
No?
You know, right. It's like...
I don't think I want to know.
No, it's good. Get your hair cut.
Okay.
Except, okay. Are we on the air?
Focus.
Oh, yeah. 313-298-WRIF. Most of you, probably all of you, if you're listening to this program, have heard of what is called the sequester coming up. And, you know... I was thinking about making a stab. I mean, it's not that difficult to understand. It's something that if they don't make some decisions, that these automatic cuts are going to go into are going to take place across the board to almost all government programs. I was just listening to these right wingers as I was coming in on the radio, and they're saying, "Good. You know, all this spending will be cut. You know, all these social programs will be cut." I guess
important ones, maybe roads and schools and things like that.
Yeah, and air traffic controllers.
Oh, well, that little thing. Just that.
Yeah. Well, it's not what'll happen, though. They're not going to send the same number of planes up. They'll just have to slow everything down.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And so, everything will get more expensive.
But I know what I'm saying. So I was in Los Angeles, right? And I was thinking, like, on the plane out there, I was reading the New York Times, and actually I saved I underlined some of the stories and saved them to, I wanted to talk about them when I got back a few weeks later and all that. But by the time, you know, 3-4 days came on, it occurred to me I wasn't even watching the news. Or then one day I said, I better watch the nightly news. And I felt like this detached observer from it all. And I think that's the way good numbers of the American people do. Because so much of it seems...
No question, Peter.
Yeah, because so much of it, well, I was going to say seems, and the way things are politically and economically structured, is beyond our control. So, yeah. I mean, I was just, these right-wingers were saying, yeah, these people are more interested in what the stars are wearing than the sequester. Well, yeah, I mean, people, I mean, for one thing, people deserve diversions. People do,
they like to be entertained.
And I, anything that I can find that is mindless, I love. I mean, my mind is going a million miles an hour all the time.
Yeah.
So anything from sports to watching to playing and all stuff like that, you know, I find okay. So I'm not faulting anybody for that. But I think people opt out because, you know, people say information is power. Information isn't power. You should have information if you want to make informed decisions. But it's not power. Power is power, which means either, you know, you're...
affecting change.
And you have, yeah, and who right now has really the power to do it way disproportionately, and that's the 1%. And,
yeah.
And their representatives in the political structure.
Mm-hmm.
So in other countries and at other times, ordinary people have combined in anything from unions to revolutions. Remember 1776?
yeah.
And made these big historic changes. But usually these think, you know, why bother? You know, we can't do anything.
I think that's a large percentage of people. And, you know, the media sensationalizes things. And if they watch Fox News, they're definitely screwed if they want to get any real information. And people just do. They throw their hands in the air. I hear people around all the time saying that to me. Julina, you know, I admire you for what you do. You know, you're really, really into it. You mean it. But I can't do it. You know, it's like, well, okay.
Well, part of it is the complexity of it all and the competing, the competing politics confuses people because one of the, I actually haven't heard it from people lately, but people will say, how do I know who to believe? I hear you say one thing.
Yeah.
I hear Rush Limbaugh say another thing. I hear MSNBC say one thing. I hear, you know, Fox News say other.
Mm-hmm.
How do I figure it out? And I'm always sort of at a loss how to answer that. I mean, just one that makes so much sense, you know, the left side of things and the right, the conservatives. I just, it's fantasy land.
Look, they're crazy. They make things up all the time.
Yeah.
They just make it up. They're making up the news.
They do. And history. Well, what I always say is that, you know, like, I mean, it ought to be at least instructive. The conservatives from the Revolutionary War on have been on the wrong side of every single social question that it ever was. Supported every wrong war. Supported, didn't even support the American Revolution. The conservatives did, right? Supported slavery and segregation. I know they were Democrats. They, you know, against unions and against the women's right to vote and on and on and on.
Yeah.
Like that.
Haters. We call them haters here in the modern day.
Well, some of them, you know, they weren't always haters. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the hate wasn't always a component part of it.
Is it control?
They were just wrong. Well, no, they're always on the side of the 1% against the vast majority of people.
About their money.
About their money, honey.
Yeah.
That's right. 313-298-WRIF. Well, here's what the New York Times says the real cost of shrinking government is that it. For about $85 billion will be cut from discretionary spending over the next 7 months. And a lot of people are saying, hey, that's really good. Except when they find out, as we were saying, it's air traffic control, it's national security, criminal justice, early childhood education, health and safety. Yeah. Research from the National Science Foundation. National parks will have shorter hours. Defense personnel, they're going to furlough a lot of civilian employees. They estimate that if this goes through, there'll be 700,000 jobs lost. Military operations, the Navy plans to shut down 4 air wings on March 1st.
That's fine. That's okay.
That's good. Yeah. Training and maintenance, which is okay.
The Army.
All right. Yeah. So here, this is interesting, one of my favorite columnists in the New York Times. You say, why, don't you live in Detroit, Peter? Why are you always reading the New York Times? Well, it's got some content.
Sure does.
That helps. Here's what Charles M. Blow says, who's in there every Saturday and does a lot with statistics. He says it's crunch time. The sequester's automatic across-the-board spending cuts are set to go into effect on Friday, and there's no plan yet to stop it. You remember this thing is that the Republicans are saying, well, we had a plan, and President Obama would not look at it. Because what the President Obama has said, that they want more taxes on the ultra-wealthy,
yeah,
and they will have spending cuts. And the Republicans say, we will not allow the rich to be taxed anymore. But anyway, this is America, this is your feeble government at its most ineffective and self-destructive. The White House favors a balanced plan that would include spending cuts and some tax increases for the wealthy. Republicans reject any solution that includes tax increases. There are two fundamentally different perspectives, only one which is supported by the majority of Americans. The Pew Research Center, USA Today, found that only 19% of Americans believe that the focus of deficit reduction should only be spending cuts. Now, this is pretty interesting. You didn't get the story. I'm reading it right out of the paper. Mm-hmm. That's unusual. Huh?
Hmm.
76% of us want a combination of spending cuts and tax increases with more emphasis on the former than the latter. That's with more emphasis on spending cuts. Okay, because, you know, government's spending all this money on stuff we don't want. So then they start asking people, what would you cut?
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't even know if we should go through this huge list, but the one thing that gets the least support is aid to the world's needy. Increase or keep the same, 49%, decrease 48%. So it's sort of a wash. But there's not even that much spent. But, I mean, I guess the idea is, why are we giving money to Haiti when Detroit's going bankrupt? I mean, people could say that.
Yeah, hear that a lot.
And then the lowest one is, would you cut money for the State Department? Only 34% of the people do. And then when it, you know, military defense, 24% want to cut. Aid to the needy in the U.S., only 24% of the people want to cut it. 71% of the people.
How about that?
Yeah. When it comes out to, let's see, like 95%, means 5% don't have. Healthcare, only 22% want to cut. And it goes on and on and on. In fact, as it goes up, Medicare, only 15%. Combat crime, 14%. Food and drug inspection, only 14% want cuts. Down to veterans benefits, 6% want to cut that.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And they probably didn't understand the question. So here people are saying they want a combination of spending cuts, but when you start asking them, what do you want to cut? People don't come up with it. Now, you can call 313-298-WRIF and say you want to cut everybody, you know, all the women and children off of welfare, or all the Social Security benefits for the people that are disabled or whatever. But, I mean, in a way, I got to say, don't even bother, because you're in an infinitesimal minority when it comes to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it people in the abstract want to do cuts. But when it comes down to the concrete, they can't come up with a single thing.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be curious what...
Well, yeah, after I just told them don't call. Yeah.
Why do you do that?
Yeah, I know, I shouldn't. Because then I have more time to talk.
No. Okay. I love hearing you.
I know.
Okay?
But,
call. Don't listen to him.
Yeah, you can call. What would you... I mean, there are things... Let me tell you this, and I'm probably repeating myself, as I frequently do. But we're talking about government as a bureaucracy. I mean, there's non-bureaucracies, right? Your family isn't a bureaucracy. Your neighborhood.
Unless you're the Waltons.
Yeah. Your neighborhood association probably isn't a bureaucracy. But even when you start getting up into small cities, things are, if your public works department is, when you get to a huge government of the largest country in the world, well, the wealthiest country in the world, in this enormous population, everything is run by bureaucracy. And guess what? There's going to be waste, malfeasance, misfeasance, mm-hmm. all of that. It goes with the territory. If you dismantle that, then you don't have veterans benefits or Social Security or education or natural disaster relief or all this stuff that the government takes on. I think there's probably better ways to administer all this governmental stuff than is going on, rather than, I don't know, citizens committees or something like that. But there probably isn't enough checks and balances. But in the meantime, what's really, well, there's another, I think I have it here. Here. There's other plans. There's a group called the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And what they have a their budget eliminates the deficit and raises a $31 billion surplus in 10 years. How could they do that? Well, Bill Clinton put a surplus together in 8 years.
Yes, he sure enough did.
And Bush and the Republicans unraveled it in 4, right?
Yes.
So their budget of the Congress.
Really, like in one.
Yeah. And as soon as he began these wars, as soon as he took the tax off of his class.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, this wealthy guy, this one percenter, says, I can't have all these rich people paying a decent tax, you know, and then he got their budget, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, creates a fairer tax system, creates new tax brackets that range from 45% starting at $1 million to 49% for $1 billion or more. These are the marginal tax rates up at the top. Under the Republican President Dwight Eisenhower, the marginal tax rate, the highest marginal tax rate, was 95%. It was almost a confiscatory.
I can't even believe that.
Yeah, so this is nothing. It implements a progressive estate tax. It eliminates corporate, you know, you're against welfare. Well, the main welfare you have to be against is corporate welfare for oil, gas, and coal companies and closed loopholes for multinational corporations. The Republicans certainly, I mean, they're all about protecting these. Obama has not come up with them at all. Prevents any cuts to Medicare. It's safeguards Social Security for 75 years. So this is the plan of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and this doesn't even get any press. And our budget,
surprising, huh?
Yeah, our budget brings our troops home, responsibly ends our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to leave America more secure, both home and abroad. And let's see, bottom line, deficit reduction of $5.6 trillion, spending cuts of $1.7 trillion, revenue increase of almost $4 trillion, and also, very important, public investment, $1.7 trillion. And hopefully what that would be as well would be shifting some of the money that goes to waste in the war budget, in the so-called defense budget, and use it to improve the infrastructure of this country, create schools that have 16 kids in it rather than
32, 35.
Yeah. What it doesn't say, doesn't cut the war budget enough. This is me. For instance, the U.S. nuclear weapons program will cost $800 billion in the decade to come. This is the great liberal anti-war President Barack Obama.
Right.
That's almost $1 trillion.
God.
It says nothing. The Congressional Progressive Caucus budget says nothing about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of overseas bases. The European Missile Shield, which is an impediment to nuclear disarmament with Russia. And nothing about dismantling these continent commands, Latin American command and Africa command that are.
I was just going to say, Obama loves himself some drones with the opening of a new base in Africa.
Niger.
And that is just so, that is, this drone thing, I wish it would get more attention. I wish people were paying more attention to that.
Sure.
It's horrible.
The top marginal tax rate is half of what it was in the 1950s under this plan. There needs to be a wealth on tax. Or I'm sorry, I wrote that down. There needs to be a wealth tax. In other words,
I was going to say a tax on wealth.
Yeah, a tax on wealth. Exactly. So that you don't have like the Walton families sequestering, if you will, over $100 billion that they did not work for. They just inherited it, right?
Oh yeah.
And anybody that has some tenderness for these multi-billionaires that run these great part of their wealth is made on out of products that come from sweatshops in Asia that have taken American jobs. And how about if we had a confiscatory tax on that kind of wealth? And so maybe 90%. So they'd wind up with $10 billion between the five of them.
And who could spend that ever?
So they'd have $2 billion apiece.
I mean, they could even invest that if they wanted to,
Yeah, like that. No. Let's say there should be a stock transaction tax. A stock transaction tax that every time, there's, I don't know, how many transactions are there a day? I mean, something, hundreds of millions or a billion or something like that. And there would be like 0.001 cent. But this would wind up to be raise billions of dollars.
Oh, that's, yeah sure. That adds good. Up.
There needs to be a higher minimum wage. We should be thinking about not $9 an hour, but a living wage. What is that, $10, $12 an hour? And some of you who may be small businessmen say, man, I'm on the edge right now. I can't afford anything more. I don't even know if I could afford $9 an hour.
Yeah.
But you could perhaps work out something where the government could subsidize businesses which can't afford to pay a living wage. Or maybe you shouldn't be in business.
Yeah, that's an idea.
Because remember, last week I was saying, what if you said you could only stay in business if you could pay people $4 an hour? And you know what? If you advertise jobs at $4 an hour, you would get takers.
I know.
Without a doubt. I mean, the people are so desperate.
I know. That's right. It's awful.
Also, things like, how about free college tuition and a canceling of all student loans?
I'm all about that.
Yeah.
All about that.
I just read about a woman, a veterinary medicine school has a college debt of $314,000.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's outrageous.
All right. Some of you on hold already. Stay there. We'll be right back, and we'll give you a report on the Oscars. If you care. Hey, it must be over. Aren't they about like 11:30 supposed to end?
I don't think it's over yet.
All right. It ain't over till it's over.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend is brought to you by The Big Bang Theory, weeknights at 7, followed by 2.5 Men at 7:30 on CW50. The Riff.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
World-class chef Lorena Garcia on inspiring Taco Bell's new Cantina Steak Burrito.
When Taco Bell started, I said, a great steak burrito starts with great steak. They send me the steak, I kept sending them back. No, not tender enough. No, it's gotta be thicker. More flavor.
It took 9 tries, but we finally nailed it. Taco Bell's new Cantina Steak Burrito with new thick-cut, deliciously marinated steak and Chef Lorena Garcia approved. Click or tap the banner for nearest store. Live Mas at participating locations.
Hey guys, it's Juliet, your Riff Rock Girl for Bulldog eSigs. I recently caught up with Bulldog Wholesale's owner, Perry Tata, and he told me all there is to know about a better alternative to smoking. Their electronic cigarettes are better for you, will save you a ton of money, taste and look like the real thing, and you can smoke them almost anywhere. To see my video, just log on to WRIF.com and go to my page. Bulldog Wholesale eSigs, a better alternative.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We can give a shout-out to Bob and the crew at KTSFN. I got to move this down. Somebody's listening way out in Brisbane, California. They listen every week.
Well, hello. Thank
you.
Hey,
guys.
Welcome.
And gals, Brisbane, California. Wow.
We love it.
Should have known that before. I would have come and visited you.
Yeah, right.
Somehow the syntax of that sentence didn't sound right. But whatever. we're talking any Oscar news? Anybody?
No.
No?
No.
What have they been doing?
Well, the supporting actor. I don't even. Someone from that Django Unchained. Christoph Waltz. I don't know. That's not exciting.
That was right at the beginning.
Anne Hathaway won for supporting actress. And then the others haven't been done yet.
And we are still having, we're just all agog, if that's a word, about Waiting for Sugar Man.
Yeah.
The story about Detroit singer Rodriguez, who won the best documentary. You know, the that's a song, Waiting for Sugar Man. And Sugar Man was a heroin dealer.
Oh.
And yeah, sort of like the Velvet Underground song, I'm waiting for my man. You know that?
Okay. Yeah, sure.
I'm waiting. Anyway, I won't sing it.
But, no singing.
No singing, no doing math on the air. But as one of the commentators, a guy I know in Waiting for Sugar Man, Jerome Ferretti, who they They say he's a bricklayer, which he is, but he's also an incredible artist.
Yeah.
But he says that Sugar Man was VW Frank, which indeed he was. And my wife and I used to get our VW repaired by Sugar Man, except we didn't know he was also dealing heroin. No one told us that.
Oh, for real?
For real.
So don't get Rodriguez confused with Sugar Man. I think that's...
Rodriguez is not Sugar Man. No. Mm. Sugar Man was... VW, who's passed away.
How about that?
313-298-WRIF.
Hey, were we going to talk about the Pope at all this week?
the best director went to Ange Lee for Life of Pi.
Oh, cool. I want to see that.
You want to see everything. You haven't seen anything.
I don't go to the theaters.
Yeah.
I just don't.
It was, I liked that, but didn't love it, mainly because
I read the book.
Oh, did you? Well, you know, it's a very exciting sea journey with a young man and a tiger.
Yes.
In the boat. However, at the beginning of the movie, it's being told by the young man later in his life, so you know he's going to survive, right? So the kind of the tension is going.
Oh, Peter, you're such a dude.
The dude abides. I just saw the Big Lebowski.
Did you really?
Yeah. I mean, I saw it when it came out, like in 98, but then I just watched it
again. I love that
movie. Yeah, everybody does. Anyway, last week, remember I said that this was rare coming out of my mouth, but that I agreed with some Republicans.
Yeah, I think I recall this. I tried to push it out of my head.
Senator Rand Paul, who is a whack job on most stuff from Kentucky, but he and the Kentucky Republicans are all about allowing the state of Kentucky, the farmers, to grow hemp.
Oh, that was amazing to me.
Yeah, that was amazing.
So he's got one...
Yeah, but how about this? Could I say anything good about Dick Cheney?
No.
Yeah.
Certainly not.
He was in an ad supporting marriage equality.
His daughter is a lesbian.
Yeah.
I mean, he's finally come around then because he was kind of pushing her out of the way.
You know those big shot Republicans, unlike the, you know, like the teabaggers, the really crazy people.
Yeah.
They, you know, they have all these prejudices and what have you. And up at the top, these one percenters, the George Bushes and the Cheneys and the Koch brothers and all that, I suspect very, very few of them have those social prejudices that that their base does.
Like, think so.
Yeah. And but also a former Republican presidential candidate, John Huntsman, voiced support for gay marriage on Thursday. I mean, part of this is pure opportunism because they've lost.
They want the vote.
Yeah. I mean, the only people they got are some middle-aged, angry white guys and a bunch of evangelicals. And you can't win very many elections at. I mean, you can, the way the Republicans control the House is through, even though they got a minority
vote.
All
the redistricting
votes,
that went on.
All the redistricting. And after a while, that's not going to work either.
Sneaky stuff.
But let's get some. We were talking about the sequestering where there's going to be these enormous cuts. It's going to affect everything from air traffic controlling to the military and research and crime enforcement and all that. I was saying anybody. And when you got down to it, very few people could think of anywhere that they could actually make the cuts. They said, yeah, we should cut a lot of stuff. And then they'd say, well, what about Social Security? Oh, no. What about this? What about that? But so I was asking for some comments. So I think Bill from KPAC has some suggestions. Bill, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
How are you doing?
We're good.
Hey, you know, what I was going to say is it's small potatoes what you guys are talking about, but, you know, it really irks me the perks that the city, the state, and feds get with their, you know, their issued cars, their gas cars, their expense accounts. What would that all total up to if they cut that out and had to drive their own cars, pay for their own fuel? I drive 100 miles one way to work sometimes.
Oh.
You know, I got to pay for that.
Yeah, no.
Not
it's
cheap.
A job. They're doing a job.
You
Why
know,
do we have to pay for their gas?
I wonder. I
hadn't really thought about that one before.
Well, it can be a part of compensation. To be sure, and it is. And what I'm wondering, Bill, is I tend to agree. There are too many perks. And when you start reading about some of these departments that have these huge parties, and they say, well, where are we going to meet? How about Las Vegas? Or how about Miami? You're running, what the hell? Come on, man. So that's the kind of thing that has to have a lot more oversight. But I wonder, you know, they have something called a payment in kind. Which means if you're getting stuff like that, that supposedly you're supposed to put it on your income tax. Like we used to in the radio world get a lot of perks. They would give us a lot of stuff, everything from CDs and jackets and all this stuff. And in terms of the IRS code, we really should have been reporting that as income in kind, but nobody
does.
That
was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think anybody does. You're right.
How many of these people are actually putting that down? I mean,
I doubt it. Well, that's what I, well,
loopholes are around it.
Absolutely. And that's what I meant. Let's see here. John, our phone screener and, assistant producer is incredible. He said Michigan state legislators, and this is Republicans and Democrats, receive an annual expense account of $10,800.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Times how many?
Yeah. So, well, as you said, Bill, it's not a tremendous amount, but you know, when people are hurting all across our state and across this country, even little bits like that, because, supposedly politicians are supposed to be serving the people, but so frequently we think they're serving themselves.
Right.
Right.
The city of Detroit, case in point, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. For sure.
Oh, my gosh.
Talk about a feeding frenzy. All right. Thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate it. But unfortunately, as Bill said, it is kind of small potatoes, and we're starting to talk about trillions here. Let's get Mike from Fenton on. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, did you hear about that Forbes magazine that Detroit is the most miserable place in the nation to live?
No.
Yeah, but I wanted to talk about the camel races. We got camel races out here in Fenton, March 9th. It's the 10th annual camel race.
Uh-huh.
And the best dressed camel will get a trophy and a prize.
Wait a minute. Did you say camel?
Yeah, camel.
Camel races. Yeah, we have camel races out here every March. It's a fundraiser that we have. It's $20 tickets in 810-964-7519 is the number if you want to get some tickets. But you guys got to come on. You'll love this.
Camels.
Okay. Here, Forbes.
Interesting.
Oh, my God. Look at this. John Miller is on the ball. Yeah, I hope, Mike, that was not a fake phone number. It wasn't somebody you disliked terribly.
I don't know. Just...
But here, let me listen to the rest of it off the air. Forbes, miserable cities. Number one, Detroit. Number two, Flint. Number three, Warren.
No kidding.
Now,
no, really?
Warren has some troubled areas, but it also has some very, very nice areas.
Mm-hmm.
Any Warreners out there that want to take issue with this? No, look, we got into this because of the banksters, right? Because of the manipulation of the financial sector. And, well, there was a number of, in general, it was the culmination of Reaganomics, of taking controls off of people that needed to be strictly controlled because of this idea that if you just unleash the job creators, they'll create a lot of jobs. Well, the opposite occurred. They created a lot of wealth for themselves, a lot of it through scams and misrepresentation, phony loans and the rest of it. Reducing significantly tax revenue by giving taxes to the wealthy. And it's very possible that a number of these conservatives wanted to reduce revenue because then they could start attacking what they call entitlement programs. Like, hey, Social Security, Grandma, you're out of here.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Good luck, yeah. Grandma. I know it's already tough for you.
Grandpa, I know you're sick. Too effing bad.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's where these people are
terrible.
Coming from.
Terrible.
But here, let me see. Primary reason for Warren's ranking is a 53% decline in home prices in the last 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, that'd be hurtful. But here, one of the things that happened, and I was looking for the article because I mentioned it last week and I couldn't find it, is that a decreasing number of people are blaming the banks and the financial institutions for the financial crisis.
Who are they blaming?
Well, I didn't say. I mean, they...
What is it? Is it kind of like, you know, water under the bridge to them? You
exactly.
Know, let's on to the next subject, well, kind of thing?
Well, think about this. It's like when I say, it's like, you know, George Bush. People go, George Bush. Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember him. I mean, that was
they
like
might
a,
even say, which one?
That was like a nightmare.
When we talk about a George Bush, there's one,
but
W.
One of the many things that Barack Obama has done wrong was to let Wall Street get off the hook for creating this financial crisis. So now the Justice Department is starting what they call to build a new model for prosecuting the big banks. So that's good, eh? In a recent round of actions that shook the financial industry, the government pushed for guilty pleas rather than just the usual fines and reforms. Prosecutors, federal prosecutors, now aim to apply the approach broadly to financial fraud cases. And you have all of this stuff here. Oh, here's the article. Duh. When an outside analysis uncovered serious flaws with thousands of home loans, J.P. Morgan Chase executives found an easy fix. So, you ready for this? They found serious flaws with these loans that they had out.
Yeah.
Rather than disclosing the full extent of problems like fraudulent home appraisals and overextended borrowers, the bank adjusted their critical reviews according to these documents that were filed in federal court. As a result, the mortgages, which J.P. Morgan bundled into complex securities, appeared healthier, making the deals more appealing to investors, and then they sold them off. And that was one of the things that that created the bubble, which then burst like that. Dexia, which is a Belgian-French bank, is suing J.P. Morgan and its affiliates, claiming it had been duped into buying $1.6 billion of troubled mortgage-backed securities. Now, what is this called? Isn't this called criminal fraud? And the bank didn't create it. Remember they say that under this Supreme Court decision of Citizens United that the freedom of speech extended to money? This is now it's the bank. There were people that did this. Let me tell you how they handled it.
In Iran, I was just going to say, you do this in Iran, you get the death sentence, basically.
That's right.
Four people convicted of participating in a $2.6 billion embezzlement scheme, the biggest fraud in Iran's history. 25 other people. Oh, and they can't appeal. They can't appeal. And 25 other people, including two government officials, have been sentenced to long prison terms and large fines as well. So what do they do here? Nothing.
Nothing. Because what happens is something like J.P. Morgan Chase could possibly be fined like $1 billion. And they'll go, oh, no, we're going to have to cut our executive compensation by 10% to everybody. But here in Iran, death sentence for four people, four bankers and businessmen, including the chief executive of the Arya Investment Group, that were convicted of, quote, disturbing the country's economic system through collusion and corruption in the banking network. That sounds like what these banksters did, didn't it?
Yes, it sure does.
well, and this is no surprise. Best actor for Lincoln.
Hugh Jackman.
No, Hugh Jackman.
Wasn't he up for Best Actor for Les Miserables?
Oh yeah, maybe you're right. I was thinking of that superhero.
Oh God, I don't even know who you're talking about.
Iron Man or something?
Oh, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln. Yeah, everybody expected that. Now, the man who predicted every single, the presidential race down to almost the percentage point, all the senatorial race.
Young man.
Was named, all of a sudden it's right out of my brain, what his name is.
Silver's?
Lou Silver.
Yeah.
Lou Silver. He has predicted, and he's not, this is all this statistics, that the best picture will be Argo.
Oh, okay.
Knock, knock.
I really do. But, no, I'm not doing it.
Go ahead.
No.
You know the joke?
No.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Argo.
Argo who?
What? Argo.
What? No. I have no idea what you're up to over there. Peter.
It doesn't matter.
Oh, my.
A lot of you guys are worried. Yeah, well, it's Nate Silver, not Lou Silver.
Nate Silver. Lou's, I was going to say Lou. He's a jeweler.
He's the diamond man.
Yeah. when I was at your house earlier, you were saying Lou Silver, and I knew, like, that is not right.
Yeah, it's Nate Silver, and it's 538.com. 538.com. And yeah, and John Miller knows the punchline to this. Argo.
Oh. Okay, I got it.
All right, you got it. A lot of you guys out there are worried about Obama's a gun grabber.
That's right. Yeah,
right.
Are they still going on about that, Peter?
No, they actually haven't heard about it. I mean, the mass killings go on apace. It's like I started to say, well, I'm going to start cranking out these stories, but they're just happening.
There's too many.
Yeah. But Congress's latest crack at a new assault weapons ban would protect more than 2,200 specific firearms. Okay? So you don't have to worry. And this is not about confiscation, right? This is, and it won't pass in any event, so don't even worry about that. But it includes a semi-automatic rifle that is nearly identical to one of the guns used in the bloodiest shootout in FBI history. One model of that firearm, the Ruger 223 caliber Mini 14, is on the proposed list to be banned, while a different model of the same gun is on a list of exempted firearms in the legislation that the
Senate. Really?
Yeah, so this is not going to make any difference. The gun that would be protected from the ban has fixed physical features and can't be folded into a more compact one. In other words, it doesn't have a folding stock. Yet the two firearms are equally deadly. Former FBI agent John Hanlon, who survived the 1986 shootout in Miami, he was shot in the head, hand, groin, and hip with a Ruger Mini 14 that had a folding stock. Two agents died and five others were wounded. What a joke, he said. Hannon recalled lying on the street as brass bullet casings showered on him. He thought the shooter had an automatic weapon.
Wow.
Both models of the Ruger Mini 14 specified in the proposed bill can take detachable magazine that hold dozens of rounds of ammunition. Former FBI agent Hanlon said, I can't imagine what the difference is. It would ban 157 specific firearms designed for military and law enforcement use and exempt others made for hunting purposes. It would also ban ammunition magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. Yet there are firearms that would be protected under the bill that would take large capacity magazines like the ones used in the mass shootings that enable a gunman to fire dozens of rounds of ammunition without reloading. So, don't worry. You will have...
You're going to be fine.
You're going to be fine. Yeah, you will have all of that. All right, let's take a call here. Here is Sweet Meat. Sweet Meat is in Fenton. Go ahead, Sweet. I'm curious to see whether this is a man or a woman. Go ahead.
I know who this is.
Okay, Sweet Meat, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Okay. What is up?
Sweet Meat.
Hi, how are you, Julie?
Good, how are you?
Doing real good. I just had a question about the inheritance tax, because I heard, Peter, your argument about the people that own, like, Walmart or whatever, they get this money and they get it from their
parents.
Inheritance from their parents or whatever. They haven't earned it or whatever, and therefore they should not get the money and that they should give it back to the government. I was just kind of wondering if you could elaborate on that.
Well, there's always been...
I'm a little different on this one from Peter, by the way. I have, you know how I am about that inheritance tax.
Well,
I think the Waltons, it's a different story.
One of the things is that the Congressional Progressive Caucus said that they should have a progressive inheritance tax. So if you're inheriting, and usually they have a base, like its inheritance is over $1 million, or I think it's even going up to $5 million now. It really, this inheritance tax doesn't even, I don't even think it hits 1% of the population. But when somebody is beginning to, leave billions to their heirs, that's when, this is part of having not allowing wealth to accumulate in the manner that it does so that you have these people in the upper 0.1%, not even the 1%. They're paupers, that are through the 99th percentile compared to the people in the 1/10. And you're talking about a few thousand families that control so much of our lives because of the wealth they have. The Koch brothers, Bloomberg, the Waltons and all that. Mm-hmm. What, Jalene, what?
Nothing.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
I'm listening.
Yeah, so almost every industrialized country in the world has a progressive inheritance tax. And You know, the rich people go, wah, 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 you know, too effing bad. You know, I don't even understand any sympathy for him. And it's like I said, if you took 90% of the wealth away from the Waltons, the five of them, they'd wind up each having $2 billion in wealth, and they could still do everything else, that they do. What do you think?
Yeah, but I'm just thinking that, let's say, for instance, my father, you know, had a hardware store, and he saved his money, and, you know, he dies. It doesn't necessarily affect only the 1% and 2% at the top. It affects anybody that doesn't have a living trust.
No. That does not come in. That does not come into play until you hit this threshold of, I can't, someone have to tell me whether it's...
Let's get our producer on that one.
Yeah. One million or 5 million. So somebody that, you know, so that if you're left $800,000, which is quite a bit, you know, you, there's no inheritance tax on it at all. Two things. One, I have to go, so thank you for bringing that up. Maybe others want to comment on that. And secondly, just as Nate Silver said, best picture, Argo. We'll be right back.
All right.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
How do you keep an older car running like new? Just ask a Ford customer. Jackie, tell me why somebody should bring their car here to the Ford dealership for service instead of those other places.
They have wonderful service. I come and make sure I get my oil changed, and when they tell you your tires need to be rotated, you got to get that done as well.
The Works, $39.95 or less, minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 3/31/13.
I'm so addicted to all the things you do when you're all around with me. In between the sheets or the sounds you make, with every breath you take, it's unlike anything when you're loving me. Ooh, girl, let's take it slow. So ask for you, are you aware to go? I wanna take my love.
Never.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
No, it's on, man.
Great. Looking
this
forward to it.
This is it.
Fine.
Let's do it. I'm ready. Go.
Everything that rocks.
I want to hear some revolution out there, brother. I want to hear another revolution. Brothers and sisters, it's time to testify. I want to know.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff's award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
313-298-WRIF, which in numbers is?
Oh, 313-298-9743. I was thinking award-winning. We need more awards.
We haven't got an award in a
we
while.
We need a new award.
You know, you ever look at, like, cognacs or even wine sometimes, and it says, best cognac at the Paris something or other in 1894. And I'm thinking, so they haven't bought anything in the last 120 years?
Maybe that's all they need.
Yeah. You know, did you know this, that Michael Waltrip, who is a NASCAR driver, in fact, wow, did you see that crack up? Those?
I actually did see that.
Whoa.
I mean, I saw an account later.
But he was riding driving in honor of the 26 victims of the Newtown massacre, and he said Waltrip and NASCAR have not taken a public stance on vital gun control legislation, but he is going. Let me see, what day was this? This was Friday night. He was going to be on the Ed Show, the Ed Schultz Show on MSNBC, which is a liberal show. And interesting statistics: 92% of Americans who support background checks on all gun sales. I'm missing this somehow. 92% of Americans support background checks on all gun sales, and including 91% in households that own guns. 74% of NRA members who themselves support universal background checks. The majority of gun owners, NASCAR fans, and military families have previously expressed support for a ban on assault weapons. Well,
interesting. Yeah. Interesting. I remember last week, I think someone called in and said there shouldn't be any background checks, just, no regulations whatsoever. That's crazy.
Yeah. All right. Let's go back to, here is some information we need. Wait a minute here. Estate tax.
Come back to me, Peter. Come on.
No, I've got too many things going.
I know.
Estate tax right now kicks in at 5.25 million right now. So in other words, it affects like this infinitesimal number of families. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And, then it's 40%. Estate tax is set to drop to a million for the 2013 taxes. So that will include more people. Here's Steve in Rochester. Steve, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's now permanent at 5 million, but it was going to drop. But part of the Obama deal that he did a couple of years back raised it to the 5 million and then indexed it for inflation.
Okay.
So now it's 5.25 million, and then there's the maximum tax after that amount of 40%. But a lot of the states are taxing this at $1 million. Like New York, the state of New York, you're going to pay a lot of tax right after $1 million, even though the federal tax doesn't kick in until $5.25 million.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I would just say just kind of the argument on the other side of this, and I don't like to see a ton of wealth accumulated, but if you accumulate the $500 million and you got to pay 40% in tax, I mean, how much should they really take?
That's kind of high, personally. Well,
I don't.
Sorry, Peter, but I'm going to break with you on this one.
Here's what I think.
It's high.
You know, there years ago, there was a book called that Everything I Know I Learned in Kindergarten.
Right,
I know. And one of the things is you don't bring candy to school unless you can share with everybody. So we're not talking about a communist society where everyone shares in everything equally. But as long as we have cities and our state and even parts of our country stressed to the point it is, I mean, why should there be this impacted wealth? I mean, 400 people in this country have a wealth that's almost $2 trillion. 400
I know,
people.
But you know, really,
give them each 5
let's
million
talk about
and tell
the
them
government.
To go home.
But, you know, I think they I don't
Hold
know.
On, Steve. We're going to argue. We'll be right back.
I think there should be, maybe some kind of tax, but not 40%. And why is the United States government, they're responsible for taking care of what's going on in this country, not the people who make money. in my opinion.
Well, here, what the Congressional Progressive Caucus said, it's what he called it. It's progressive. So if you make $1 million, maybe you pay 5%, right?
Okay.
If you make, that's what's being inherited. If you make $100 million, maybe it's 20%. If it's $1 billion, maybe it should be 80%.
I just don't agree. I this is the one place for all these years,
eat
Peter, that you and I have not. I'm with you on that, but you know
what? Eat the rich, except for
don't make them the people who need to fix the problems in this country through their inheritance.
Well, it is about distribution of wealth.
I know. We've always had this, Peter.
Steve, go ahead.
Peter, if I make $100 million, the government's going to tax me federal and state well above 40%. So then I'm going to have $60 million. Then when I die, they're going to tax me on all but $5 million of my $60 million, another 40%, and the state's going to tax me again on that. That's one way to look at it, as certainly double taxation. The other way is if I make my $100 million, and let's say I was just about to give it away to 100 different people. I was going to give them each $1 million, all my extended family. And the day before I went to go straighten out all the paperwork to get that done, I got hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I couldn't give it to all my relatives. Instead, the government would step in and take it.
You
is
know,
that fair?
Is it fair that we have millions of people going through, or several million people in this country going through trash cans looking for return bottles, where you have other people
dumpster diving for food?
Yeah, well, you have other people that are, and I always look at, you know, I'm always the New York Times, and you know, they have little trinkets that are people are buying,
like a pen for $10,000 or something.
All right, but I get your point, I appreciate it. Thank you. Let's see here, rate. Okay, all right, let's go to Rick. Rick is in Macomb. Hey, Rick, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Rick.
I'm assuming you guys are liberal progressive redistributionists, right?
No.
we're
just
radical.
Just a wild guess.
We got to go way more left of that. We fall off there.
Oh, you're off the cliff on that one?
We're off the cliff on a lot of things.
Okay.
In a good way.
Let me ask you guys just a couple easy, quick questions. How many pages is the Declaration of Independence?
How about this? How about if I ask you, can we please talk about some stuff that's important?
Well, go ahead. Get to your point. What's your
point
here point with this?
Right.
Well, you guys keep talking about all this inequality. I'm sure you guys are against the CEO to worker compensation inequality, right?
Right, sure.
Okay. Do you realize when the highest rate of that was?
Well, we're at the highest it is than I think in the last 80 or 90 years, right?
No, we're not. No, we're not.
Well, we can't argue
about
facts.
In the 90s, it went from 58 with a ratio of 58 to 1 in 1990 to a ratio of 393 in 2000. Now, who was president then?
Well, wait a minute. You are not going to get us defending the Democrats or Bill Clinton or whatever.
Right.
There are two corporate parties. One of the differences, the only thing difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party is the Republican Party are unabashed greedy, well, support the unabashed greedy accumulation of wealth by the top 1%. The Democratic Party is filled at least with some people with a conscience and common sense and caring about people, and also it's their base. So they have to talk about social justice. They have to talk about some wage equality and what have you. Ultimately, they're both in service to the corporations. It was in tandem. The Republicans put forth this bill for NAFTA, which emptied so much of this country of its industrial jobs. And the majority of Democrats in the Senate opposed it. And it was dear Bill Clinton who signed it in. So that's your example of bipartisanship.
Yeah, we could talk for a long time about things we think Bill Clinton did wrong. So if you want to go there, go right ahead.
but that's the whole thing. It's driven by the Democrat liberal progressives.
Oh, please. That's a pretty large blanket statement.
What do you mean the Democrat? You mean like one single person?
You guys keep telling us about your big tent.
No, I don't. There's no big. What are you
about? Our big what?
Tent.
Big tent?
So, you know, I don't know. This is a thing. This is something where you're supposed to get everybody underneath it. And And
sounds like a good time. Let's do it.
listen, Rick, if for some reason or other, and you're not in the 1%, you are supporting this redistribution of wealth. And because the Republicans actually are the biggest redistribution of wealth advocates, and they've carried it out with a vengeance. And what's happened is that the middle class and the working class have been looted of the wealth that they've produced over the last 30 years. This is Reaganomics, and it's all gone up. Every time that there's some, you know, wealth growth, it's redistribution. All the wealth has gone to the wealthy because that's what Reaganomics does.
But who is the benevolent, unbiased, nonpartisan arbiter that's going to determine how much I should be able to make? Or what you guys love mostly is a living wage. Will the living wage allow me to get a 900-square-foot apartment or a 2,500-square-foot house?
Well, maybe what we're talking about is that in the wealthiest country in the world, that you have the highest rate of poverty. With any standard, I suspect, Rick, that you would hold, that half of this country is either poor or near poor by standards which I think you and I would agree upon, that if we found ourselves in those circumstances, we'd be extraordinarily unhappy, really stressed, feeling like
we're hopeless.
Yeah.
And you need to also consider, I mean, have a heart, man. One in four kids every night goes to bed with an empty stomach. Have a heart.
And that's because of the maldistribution of wealth, because there is this, because capitalism itself is based on looting. And it's everything that a capitalism has ever accomplished is based on looting. And one of the things that we want to do is we want to ease that process. And the only, unfortunately, because I don't trust government, I don't like governments. Governments have almost always been tyrannical. But I don't know what else to do now, other because the toothpaste is out of the tube, is to have all these rules and all these regulations, yeah, bureaucracy, that limits the ability of the powerful and the wealthy to loot.
But that's exactly what I'm telling you. We have spent $17 trillion since 1965 on poverty. The rate was 14.3 in 65. Today it's 14.3, 15.1 if you include recessionary effect.
Right.
So how many more trillions of dollars can we pour into that poor class?
Okay. Now this is getting ugly.
Yeah,
all right.
When
I'm testifying with my hand in the air, you know it's getting ugly. What about the trillions of dollars we've spent on illegal wars? How about that? One illegal war in Iraq.
How much have we spent on Iraq? And
trillions.
Yeah. But listen, you know.
You should be mad about that. About taking care of people who have nothing.
Well, what he's saying, it has some truth to it. He's speaking from a point of no compassion,
right,
obviously.
And
I'm sorry. I'll let you respond to that in just a minute, Rick. That these so-called great society programs are supposed to alleviate poverty just didn't work, because essentially what you had is you created this sort of bureaucratic class of government workers who would do retraining and they would do education, you know, all this stuff like this. But it's not what it's about. It's about the distribution of wealth. And as long as you have this minimum wage is getting lower and lower because of inflation, well, people are always going to be poor.
How are they supposed to get out
of it? As long as you allow a system that, as long as you allow the people to control the system to ship all these jobs overseas because they can pay people starvation wages in Asia, like this was, like it's 1865 or something, that's going to continue. Yeah, I think the so-called war on poverty was a colossal flop.
You mean shipping jobs to Europe or to Europe and Asia, like GE, Jeff Immelt, our former job czar, has sent, and...
I know. Listen, they're all complicit. I mean, why would you be... We're not
let's talk about GE not paying any taxes.
Yeah, we're not a Democrat. Why would you be a Republican?
I'm not a Republican.
All right.
Let's
end it right there.
No, what are you?
I'm a...
All right, I'll tell you what I am. I'm a Reagan conservative. I'm a constitutional religious and a fiscal libertarian.
Well,
you admit that?
Well, I'll tell you, it's Reagan is one of the worst presidents that ever existed. He's responsible, and his he was like a sandwich short of a picnic. But by the way, Rick, the Declaration of Independence was one page, I think. All right, thank you. Let's see. That was fun, though.
Good times.
Yeah. I mean, that's what. All right.
Just that's carry on, yeah. Peter.
Here's Paul
moving
in Royal
right
Oak.
Along.
Paul, how you doing? You're on the air.
I agree with the Reagan conservative.
You're right. With what?
He agrees with the Reagan conservative.
Oh, okay.
Yep. Absolutely. Reagan conservative. That's all you got to do right there.
Well, wait a minute, Paul. Reagan.
That was like the most. I mean,
Reagan ruined everything, man.
Hey, be quiet.
No. Whoa.
Oh, you know what we say to that.
Yeah.
Bye-bye,
adios, MF.
Oh, God.
I love this job.
Listen, and I want to throw
all
this in.
All this in a paycheck, too.
I know. In addition, I'd like to say to Paul and Royal Oak, have another cocktail. Have a good night. All right. See you later.
Yeah. You know, there is, for instance... in Detroit, things are just in such horrible shape. And the fact, again, that we, we allow, cities all over America to, experience a kind of, troubles that they're in. And it is just.
And the solution isn't these emergency managers.
No. Nearly half of owners of Detroit's 305,000 properties failed to pay their tax bill last year.
I could not believe that when I said
yeah.
that.
And creating this punishing cycle of declining revenues and diminished services. A lot of people just saying, hey, we're not getting anything. Why should we? 47% of people didn't pay their bills. That's almost $250 million in taxes and fees that went uncollected.
Yeah.
Fred Phillips, a homeowner, said, why pay taxes? Why should I send them taxes when they aren't supplying services? It's sickening. And one of the things they kept pumping up the taxes because as the city needed more and more money. But, you know, the city was deindustrialized beginning 60 years ago, the process began. Didn't have anything to do with Coleman or Kwame or anything like that. I mean, there is this underlying racism that somehow once African-American people got hold of the city, they sent it to hell in a handbasket.
Right.
I mean, Kwame Kilpatrick
he's a special case.
Yeah, and it didn't have anything to do with his race.
That's
he
right.
was just a crook.
That's
and,
right.
And what have you, then when you have... When you have collapse, it encourages corruption. And
no question.
That's no excuse. And, I think he's probably going to be sent away, and he and his buddy's going to be sent away for a long time.
Do you think so?
You think
a long time?
Yeah.
Oh, they're already dropping charges and things, you know?
Are they?
Along the way, yeah. I can't even remember which one it was, but I saw something.
That you have this deindustrialization when Detroit was, and Detroit was left finally as this empty shell,
AKA the Packard plant.
Yeah,
you know that says it all right there.
So it's inconceivable to me that is there only a few of us who think we live in the wealthiest country in the world and we have these cities that allegedly need financial managers or that we know for sure that are in grave financial. Shape.
Mm-hmm.
I forgot to tell you this. Our little city just lost two more foresters. Now the people that take care of the trees.
Oh, we did?
Yeah.
Aw.
Yeah, that's not good. I mean, it's public works employees. So now in this little city that we live in separate homes with different partners, it's cutback. And on the other hand, it's like I said, you open the New York Times and...
Aren't they building a new big city hall, though?
That was all done with stimulus funds.
Okay.
That was good. That was actually good. Let's see. Michelle Obama presented the Best Picture Award by satellite.
Did she really?
That's kind of odd.
Wow, yeah, sure.
I don't know why, but that's cool.
Well, you know, they're a little more... There's more Hollywood going on in politics these days, right?
A little early. I forgot him. Who was the other person? There was this ad for marriage equality, and it was with Dick Cheney, whose daughter is gay.
Yeah. And well,
he's
not worried about losing
the
office
election,
because
yeah.
of that now. So and, he'll be good dad to his daughter.
And also, what is her name? Laura Bush.
What'd she do?
She also
Dimebag Laura do?
She was, that's what used to call her in high school, folks.
No, it was college. She was selling dime bags of weed. I know it's true.
It must have been a long time ago. Dime bags.
Dime
bag.
I know.
It's a dime. $10?
I think so.
Yeah. But, but anyway, they, and some other prominent.
What did Laura do?
She and Cheney were in this ad for marriage equality.
Oh, she was in it with him. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So as I'm
wow.
saying, at the upper echelons, they don't express this virulent racism, this misogyny, this anti-immigrant thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just, you know, as long as you got the money and they don't care.
They don't care. They're unaffected. Look, well, that's the realistic thing.
Oh
to
yeah,
do.
Yeah, yeah. And thank God. Why am I doing this? John, why don't you do this show? He knows so much more. Colin Powell was also in the ad.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Right, you know,
exactly.
He's gotten better through the years.
He says, I'll do the show with you guys. Next time I'm gone, one of my globetrotting jaunts, you and John can do it. What do you say, John? You want to do it? Yeah, I hear him breathing hard. Yeah. Okay. Here's Mike and Clyde. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. You guys talking about income tax. I think that we should just prorate it to what it should be when they originally started it, which I believe it figures now somewhere around $80,000 before anybody would pay tax.
Mike,
well,
I love you.
This sounds like you, Peter, but Peter starts at 50.
Yeah, you're more rad than I am, Mike.
Well, that's basically what prorated inflation would be with how much we've had and where it started out at. And then get rid of the loopholes after that, and that makes up the difference. We don't have to worry about minimum wage as much because you get rid of all those taxes, and we'd make them a livable wage.
I don't know what to say other than I agree with you. And people would say, well, gee, wait a minute. If you had that kind of removal of revenue, where would we get the money to operate the government? It could be made from the folks above it. Oh, you know what I forgot to mention, Mike? Is that one of the things from the Congressional Progressive Caucus was to remove the cap on the payroll tax, on the FICA tax. So right now it ends at about $106,000 or something like that. So if your income is $20 million a year, you're paying FICA tax on $106,000, period, and then you're free from it. So these little things, wait a minute, you know, people say, Werby, you're such a rad, you know, you want to confiscate all this wealth and all that. Literally, as you said, Mike, if you close the loopholes, if you remove the Bush tax cuts, if you stopped funding these illegal wars, if you had a small, you know, a infinitesimal transaction tax on the stock market, did I say close the loopholes? And, and you know, like right now, we're paying hundreds of millions of dollars to, you know, these big agribusiness firms and all that. We wouldn't even.
It would stimulate the economy.
Sure. One of the things that happens if you get more money into the, I mean, people that are making $78,000 and below, they don't save a lot. And particularly as you, you know, get down to like $50,000 and all that. So every penny more that they have to spend, they're going to spend it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And one real quick question, if I could. I heard they introduced a bill in the state about putting compassion centers, making them legal. Do you know, was that Democrat, Republican, or is there a way to support that, or is there any more?
I don't know. The compassion centers are medical marijuana.
The last I heard is that they weren't they going to close a bunch of them down?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's also
put a bill in, they said, to make them legal.
Okay, well, it's also very confusing, these medical marijuana laws, and it's going to, it just,
they haven't sorted it out.
We said that. It's going to shake out.
And here, we were kind of arguing with this guy earlier, and he mentioned at one point he was libertarian. I would say Republicans in the legislature that are libertarians would, they'd be all
vote
about.
Vote for it, yeah.
Vote for it. The conservative Republicans certainly wouldn't. All right, Mike, thanks for calling in from
Never Clyde. Understand why they're so afraid of people smoking flowers.
Yeah. I mean, sending people to,
for lengthy, yeah, filling the prison system.
Where is that?
I know which,
I can't find this.
Are you looking the one for, about the commercial?
No.
Or the ad, or the sponsoring of the football stadium?
Oh, that's in here. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a company that runs prison, a private company, and it says, this article says it's led to memorable examples like Enron Field. That was this crooked company that we're
friends with. Enron. Right? Gosh, I haven't thought about that for a few.
How about the KFC Yum Center?
What?
That's what they call it, the KFC Yum Center. I forgot where it actually says where it is. And there was also a University of Phoenix stadium that's not at the university, it's not there. Anyway, this new one.
Well, because it's online, right?
In Boca Raton, the Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton has just firmed up a deal to rename its football building the GEO Group Stadium. And this is probably the ultimate. It's because the GEO Group is a private prison corporation.
God. And that's out of control.
Yeah, why don't you have the Blackwater? they could sell that.
Wow.
You got enough cash, you can do it. $6 million, they got the naming rights.
That is such a ho move on the part of FAU.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
You did say ho.
I did.
Yeah, they're whoring out. I mean, how embarrassing. How would you like to play ball in a... And John, you can tell... Oh, the KFC Yum Center is in Louisville, Kentucky.
But I don't get what that is. Is that another stadium?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like yum. Yummy.
Okay.
Yummy.
KFC,
yummy, yum.
Please.
I don't have the author here, but this is Unplanned Prisonhood. I think the guy's name is Berkowitz or something. I copied it, but didn't left his name out. It says, America's federal prison system is broken. Forget about the state stuff. Facilities are literally bursting at the seams. Overcrowding is endemic. Prisoners are being isolated, leading to severe mental health problems that go untreated. Staffing is inadequate. Taxpayer dollars are flying out the window to maintain facilities because they got to keep expanding them. And one of the major reasons for this massive breakdown is that over the past 30 years, the federal prison population in the United States has increased by almost 800%.
Whoa.
Let's see. In 1980, the federal prison population was 25,000, and it's increased almost 10 times.
And is this alluding to anything about, the drug war and how it's filling the prisons? Is that what it is?
Sure. That's exactly what it's about. There's a... new people being incarcerated for immigration and weapons-related offenses, but the largest portion of the newly admitted inmates are being incarcerated for drug offenses. Like,
ridiculous.
Haven't learned a damn thing, have we? But can you imagine that? I mean, think about, well, even some of it. Remember, I mean, I guess, you think about Detroit's history, and for years, the stadium was called Briggs Stadium after Briggs Manufacturing. In fact, the UAW, it was a union shop, UAW shop, and when there was a labor dispute with Briggs, they would the UAW would go down and pick at the ballpark. Informationally, they wouldn't try to stop people from going in. And then, but it always seemed kind of cool. It was Tiger Stadium, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't even know who, they had Ebbets Field, and, they had Yankee Stadium, and I'm trying to think of all the rest of them. But now, Comerica Park.
Wrigley Field.
Wrigley. Yeah, but those were, that's a...
Oh, that was after the...
Yeah, the...
Corporation, was it?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
But still, they seemed to have... It didn't seem quite as offensively modern.
Yeah, right.
Like that. Like KFC Yum Stadium.
God.
I can't believe it. But do they still do this? They used to, at the seventh inning, they would sing God Bless America.
I don't know. I don't think they sing that anymore. There's a little stretch.
Take
me out to the ball game. That's what they sing.
Because I've told people that here in Detroit, in the seventh inning, we would sing God Bless Comerica.
Oh, God.
And they go, really?
Oh,
that's a bank, folks. That's a bank.
I think everyone around here gets it.
I want to repeat something because I just want to get some people there. Are you going to come to this? There's a debate in Windsor co-sponsored by the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship and the Windsor Essex County Atheist Society, where Dan Barker, the co-president of Freedom From Religion Foundation, is going to debate Reverend Joe Boot, the founder of the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity, on the question, is there life after death? Now, I wouldn't even, if someone said, I used to say I would debate anybody on the question of belief in God or anything like that.
That's not true, though.
Well, yeah.
You've had a few people call.
I'll say why I wouldn't do it. But if someone said, is there life after death? I mean, here's my talk. I would say, I doubt it. I can't imagine.
Is that all you've got?
Yeah. Well, what else would you say?
Yeah. I mean, really, what would you say? You're right.
So I'm actually curious about what both of these guys say, because the Christian, Reverend Joe Boot, I mean, he can only make inferences from a book.
Yeah.
Right? That he thinks is
real.
Real. Yeah. And Dan Barker, he can only say, I don't think there is. I have no reason to suspect.
So why are you going to this?
I want to see what both of them have to say.
I can't go. I actually have class that night.
Okay. This is March 7th in Windsor. And if my website gets back online, I don't know what the hell's happening. I got my man on it.
Get him on it, Peter.
Got my man,
Rob. People need your information.
You can do it. He's not even in the city.
I know. It's a beautiful thing.
Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And, you know.
Don't we need to go have a meeting with him?
We visited him, remember?
Which one?
When we were in Florida together.
What?
Or maybe you didn't go with me. Yeah, we did. We were down in Florida. We visited people. They lived on the boat.
Oh, sure. Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. Now,
Somebody's probably thinking, well, they just blew their cover. They always say they're not a couple, and here they're going to Florida together.
We've been all over together.
We have been all
California, New Mexico, we've been all over. I still think it's funny that, like, honestly, someone called and said, I thought you guys, for like the last 5 years, I thought you guys were married.
Well,
what? I don't get it. We talk about your wife all the time.
Yeah, but remember that one time we were in an airport in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yeah, and someone saw us you.
And you turned around and they went, huh? You know, like they were.
where's, I almost said her name.
Yeah, she doesn't allow her name to be said.
No.
Because she's not a real person. No, she is real.
She's very real.
Yeah. Remember, in fact, longtime listeners know that I can't even say our dog's name.
No.
What is with
her? She's strange. I do agree with the one rule that she gives you is not to sing on the air, though.
Yeah. And yours, she's not wise. To do math on the air.
Don't, no math.
Because I was just thinking about 10 times and 790.
Don't do it.
All right. Yeah, let me see. Oh, yeah. How about, there's a book called He, She, and It by Marge Piercy, who's an incredible novelist. Gone to Soldiers, she's written. I just saw her in Ann Arbor speaking a couple months ago now. Uh-huh. And in He, She, and It, people have the internet in their brains. And she wrote this way before the internet. This is pretty interesting. And terrorists are roaming around blowing people. They can get a hold of them and blow your brains out.
What are you talking about?
This book, He, She, and It,
yeah?
Where the internet is implanted in your head.
Oh! Did you see those Google goggles?
That's it. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. Frank's Red Hot Sweet Chili Sauce, perfect for dipping on vegetables and shrimp or for marinating chicken, pork, or beef. Try Frank's Red Hot Sweet Chili Sauce today.
I put that on every.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
The domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell is dedicated to leveling the playing field for men in divorce and now is offering complimentary 30-minute initial consultations. Men choose Cordell & Cordell because they want to feel that their interests and the interests of their children are aggressively championed. Everyone involved in a divorce is affected by the breakup of the family. Cordell & Cordell seeks to help you through this difficult time and to ensure your rights are protected so you can move on with your life. If you're a man confronted with a marriage you can't save, you should consider Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. To schedule your complimentary 30-minute initial consultation, please call 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in Ann Arbor, Novi, and Troy.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Hi, it's our final segment, and all the Oscars are in. We don't know who won Best Actress, do we? Hey, John Miller, get on it. He will tell us in a minute. Best movie? Argo.
Mm-hmm.
Knock, knock. Okay, we're not going to go through that again.
No, we are not doing that again.
Remember a little earlier I gave a shout-out to radio station KTSF? I should have known that the last was in San Francisco, right? Their city of license, SF, San Francisco. Right?
Yeah, I got it.
But the person who called in, Linear Bob, says that he's a lifer in broadcasting, a broadcast engineer by trade, and happened to figure out when you are live, so I thought I would fire up the shop computer and try listening to WRIF streaming live. I also thought I'd give you a call to let you know you have a listener here in Brisbane, California, just south of San Francisco. He said, a million years ago, I heard Peter sitting in for Mike Malloy. It wasn't that long ago.
We both did that.
It was hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Yeah, it was like 10 years ago.
Was it? Okay. Mm-hmm. And I've been a time-shifting listener of yours ever since. I'm amazed that the management, this is the part I wanted to talk about. I'm amazed that the management ownership of WRIF lets you talk as freely as you sound in terms of being able to talk about just about anything.
Well, what's the great thing about that is
they do.
They believe in freedom of speech.
Yeah.
We're in the radio business, right? Okay.
Yeah, he says, the folks who work at group-owned stations often have incredible layers of supervision and management above them, and most of the folks seem to think that the Reich wing is the only kind of political talk that should be on the air. Well, I suspect probably if I was a Reich wing, they would probably give me the same leeway.
Yeah.
Right? Thanks again for being holding forth in a part of the country where I doubt the prevailing political wind is blowing your way. Untrue, though, Linear Bob. I mean, Michigan went big for Obama.
Yeah.
Certainly the area around here, all the counties did. But he says, because of the internet, your audience is now more spread out. Indeed.
Yeah, we've got listeners all over the world. We love it. We appreciate it. Thank you so much for finding us and for being here.
Yeah, just last week, Lonnie called in, or then wrote in from Tokyo, right?
Yes.
Let's see. Jolene, please tell us how you know Laura Bush peddled weed.
It was in that book by Molly Ivins.
Is that right?
The Shrub, wasn't it in?
Oh, The Shrub, yeah.
Wasn't it in that book?
I think so. Well, I'll tell you what. Why are we doing the work for you? In fact, wait a minute. You won't even have to do the work. Why don't we Miller.
I know.
Type that in.
I'm not positive it's true, but I love the story.
Yeah, yeah. What the hell?
I mean, it's not like, you know, I'm not being Fox News-ish. It was really actually, I read it somewhere.
So look. wow, wait a minute here. John's got, I need a bigger screen. Can I get this screen any bigger?
No.
Let's see. Surprisingly, 8 of the 32 NFL teams have not sold naming rights to their fields yet. Ford Field naming rights deal $40 million over 20 years. Jennifer Lawrence got Best Actress.
Okay.
For Silver Linings Playbook.
Did you see that movie? No, me neither.
My wife did. Anyway, we were talking about Marge Piercy's book, He, She, and It, where you have the internet implanted in your head.
Yeah.
But now you can wear Google glasses and...
This kind of freaked me out a little bit.
Yeah, so I read the Google searches for style, and I was thinking people were saying, are people going to be that much a creature of electronic media that they're going to be wearing glasses where they have this little screen in front of their eyes?
Right there, yeah.
Yeah, and no, it's the concern is that the glasses don't look very cool.
Please. They need to get their priorities straight, as my mother used to say to me.
I just wonder about being immersed. Yeah, I listen a lot.
It's like a microchip, but you can take it off.
Yeah, but why would people want to do this all the time? When I was flying back from Los Angeles, what was it, a week ago? Jesus, 2 weeks already? 2 weeks ago tonight. I there was a father in the middle seat. I had an aisle seat. And then at the, you're wondering why I didn't fly first class. Huh?
Oh,
look at this.
You're not pretentious.
How about this? Well, geez,
but you would take it.
Yeah.
I remember when we went to Washington, D.C. to do a live broadcast, and there were like two rooms left. One was a regular room, and one
room.
Was a grand ballroom.
Oh, the room I got.
With a full dining room in it and a grand piano. You took the big room. Put me in that little room.
I got a 1,200-foot hotel room. Square foot.
So hotel unbelievable.
Room. Because they had messed up and they didn't have a regular room for me.
Yeah.
But it was
you
weird.
You could have given me the big room.
Yeah, I know.
I'm still mad at you.
Yeah, I invited you in.
I got a tour.
All right, the glasses. So I'm sitting on the plane, and then so this father is talking to, it looked like maybe a 17-year-old son, and the kid looked just really pained, and he said, "Dad, I'm going to listen to my music." And so then he slapped on his iPod.
Headphones, yeah.
Listened to music for the next 4.5 hours.
Wow. Well, that's one way. Planes are boring.
It is. I mean, maybe he would say, "What'd you do, man? You read a novel? You know, you're weird. You're 20th century." But so I don't understand wanting to be that immersed in media all the time.
Well, you know, that's the kids these days. They're playing the video games. You know, but the one thing I'll say is there are kids who still play outside next door to your house. There's these
kids.
Yeah, they do. They play football and games out there. It's so rare to see that anymore. Yeah.
People have those, what do you call those things that are in your ear?
Oh, the Bluetooth?
Is that Bluetooth? Yeah. George Carlin says.
It's a nerd tooth.
Yeah, it's... Boots are these, "Mr. Important, Mr. You got your hands free. Come over here and scratch my ass."
That's fabulous.
Except
yeah.
he doesn't even need some other part of his anatomy.
Oh, you know, it was George.
So, I don't know. They're talking about designing these glasses that people wear like jewelry. I just, I don't
get it.
Yeah, it
says they have a tiny screen that appears much bigger from the wearer's perspective than it does on the frame. So it's.
What about people driving?
Listen, they can. I know! Glass wearers can take pictures or record video without using their hands. That's creepy, right? That's just plain creepy. And send the images to friends or post them online. See walking directions. Search the web by voice command and view language translation. Wow. That's kind of scary, Peter.
John researched this. Allegedly, Laura Bush sold dime boxes while at SMU. What is it?
Dime boxes or bags?
Well, it says boxes here. While at SMU, what was it? Southern Methodist
University. Yeah.
But lots of folks say it's not true. Seems to be a mystery.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go with facts. I'm going to go with she did.
All right. Here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice.
Allegedly.
What's up?
Hello, Peter and Jolene. How you doing?
We're good.
Well, Maurice, how's it going, my friend?
What's going on, okay? Peter, I got a question to ask you.
Sure.
Maybe you can get black. Why is the United States military one of the greatest militaries ever assembled on this earth and not really won a war since World War II?
Well, because they're always fighting.
Because it's war.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is the United States outnumbered the Vietnamese forces 5-1 and inflicted millions of casualties, mostly civilian casualties.
Population control, baby.
That what?
Population control.
Population control.
Well, but I don't know. But point being.
Iran is doing the same thing in Iraq and Iran.
Oh, do you think they're trying to control the population by killing all these people?
I think it's all. This is going to sound silly.
Yeah.
But you know what? If you go back to World War One, how it was 20 million people was killed in World War One, mostly civilians. Every 20 years is a generation. What do we think would have sped off of that would have been? You all would have been overpopulated by now if they wouldn't have killed 20 million people.
Well, they're. That and the flu. The flu took about 20 million people, 30 million people in World War II. It was a...
How about the plague?
It was a bloody century. Well, that's food for thought. Thank you, Maurice.
Yeah. Maurice is always thinking that, man.
So, I don't know. I just sometimes... you know, it's easy to say, oh, you know, you're just from another generation. So, You don't understand. Young people want to be immersed in media. I don't know. I mean, can the brain take it? What was
I think that it's very cluttered. I think it clutters the brain.
Yeah, there's an ad on television that says two is better than one, so you can talk and surf the web at the same time.
Jeez.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say that some...
I mean, it's just going to keep...
Yeah, I mean, I was doing, I mean, you do that sometimes. Like, I was talking to my sister about this project she's doing. So we were, I had her.
You're looking at the screen and talking.
So I guess it's not much different if you have it, a little handheld one. What's the difference, right?
Yeah.
But, I don't know, isn't there any desire for silence anymore?
Silence? How about a walk in nature? How about that?
Well,
hey,
you can go to Yahoo for that, or to YouTube for that.
Yeah, you're right about that. That's scary, isn't it?
Right.
I don't know. I prefer. I've got to go hug a few trees now and then. You know.
Well, yeah, because we are
tree huggers.
Tree huggers. You know, there's just wrapping up a few things here. You can still call 313-298-WRIF. There was this 2010 decision by the Supreme Court called Citizens United.
A horrible decision.
Yeah, which
let's
struck
say.
Down limits on the kind of spending that billions and billions of dollars could be put in, or billions of dollars could be put
it
in.
It just opened it up for campaigns.
Yeah. And essentially what it did was to allow like the Koch brothers and people like that to attempt to buy elections. Interestingly, it didn't work out real well for them. One of the things that, so they always sound even-handed, is that they say it struck down limits on independent campaign spending by corporations and unions, as though there's an equivalency. For one thing, the unions do not want to spend this money. They're doing it defensively because they know the Romneys or the Bushes or whoever else that the conservatives are going to put up are going to attack the living standards of middle class and working class people and try to destroy unions. I mean, one of the main goals about all this austerity that they're putting forth as policy now has to do with they're trying to destroy the remnants of unions. This whole thing with the post office, they see this as a way to destroy the postal workers union. So now they're going to take up another case. They're going to hear a challenge to federal campaign contribution limits. No limits. So I'm suggesting, you know, only about half the people vote anyway, right?
Well, it's less than that.
Well, depending on the election. But this, I think it was about 56% or something like that. John, how much percentage of people voted in the last election? He'll, anyway, let me see. I remember we were talking about dime bag Laura Bush. They said it was in boxes and not bags, which made it unique. Maybe she had little designer boxes for her.
I hadn't heard that, but that's pretty funny.
Yeah. You know, if like half the people aren't voting anyway, maybe we could just scrub the other half, right? And what you could essentially do is just do a bidding process.
For office?
Yeah. So the president, it would be whoever raised the most amount of money.
No.
Would be the president.
It's horrible.
Wouldn't that short circuit a lot of what we're going through now?
A lot of the BS.
I mean, if you're going to allow money to have that kind of impact on our elections, why not just say, hey,
raise the money.
Raise the money. That's right.
So. Well, they're raising the money, and, something needs to be done about it, for sure.
You mentioned earlier about there's a new drone base in Niger.
Yes.
And this is opening a new front in the drone wars against al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And President Obama announced on Friday that about 100 American troops have been sent to Niger in West Africa to help set up a new base from which unarmed predatory aircraft would conduct surveillance in the region. Well, it's only 100 troops, and the predator drones are unarmed, so no worry, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we're going to be sending a lot of troops there and having armed drones and what have you.
Mm.
The problem is that one of the main focus now of al-Qaeda is no longer some of the other issues that they have, like occupation of the Holy Land, Saudi Arabia, support the war in Afghanistan. It's American drone attacks on civilians. So this
that's
is like,
right.
This
and is, there was a whole lot about Israel as well.
Yeah, but now they're really about drones. And so when their propaganda now is that this foreign invader from way across the ocean
yeah.
is sending these drones to kill people.
Yeah. I mean, wouldn't you be mad?
Yeah. And the point is that they're mad is because we're in their face and in their space.
And trying to control other lands.
Yeah.
You know?
And the oil of it, too. So,
yes.
I mean, I think
Let's
that a lot
that.
Of people are skeptical that if we disengaged from the Middle East and from Africa and from Asia in terms of confronting these groups, that they would cease their hostility towards us. But if you read what motivates them, it mostly is that we've gone beyond our geography, mm-hmm. that we've gone outside of our limits. And people say, well, you're an isolationist. Sure, we should be involved in world affairs, but on a peaceful level, not having hundreds and hundreds of bases all around the world. Now that we've allowed... these American civilians can be, American citizens can be killed by these drone strikes. And they have, for instance, now, they have a new medal that honors drone pilots and computer experts.
Wow.
So these people that are sitting in Colorado Springs that are playing video games, except they're maybe taking out an apartment house we just have their word for it, that may have an Al-Qaeda operative there. Let's even give them the benefit of the doubt. And there's some collateral damage of about 15 other people, women and children. And you could say, you know, there's a lot of arguments to be made. What's the difference between that and dropping some 500-pound bomb during a war? I mean, civilians are the ones that get chewed the most now in wars, not soldiers. But it does tend to piss people off, for sure.
Yeah, it does. You know, Robert Fisk book, something about Middle East, civilization in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I can't remember what that. That really explains well, if anyone's interested in the Great War for Civilization. Is that what it's called?
Something like that.
Yeah, Robert Fisk. Just look that up and you can find it. He explains. He interviewed Osama bin Laden on several occasions and has spent the majority of his time concentrating on the Middle East. And it explains... a lot of why they're doing it. And like you were saying, it explains it on a real personal level, what they're saying. And they don't, even though, yes, they're crazy, okay? Yes, what they do is wrong. But when you, hear their point of view from like a human standpoint, it's really not that crazy. What they do about it is crazy, but their feelings are not crazy.
And there's never any justification for killing civilians, unarmed people.
Yeah.
Regardless.
You know, babies.
You know what it's like? It's these two friends of mine, this couple, and my wife and I were eating dinner. It was on the Detroit Southwest side, and another friend, all of a sudden the door flies open. You know, it wasn't locked or anything. And it's this other friend, particularly of theirs, but a guy I knew as well. His shirt is half ripped off. He's got blood on his face. And he says, what happened? I was just down at blah, blah, bar. And he says, I just got in this damn fight. He's just, you know.
Really?
Yeah, like that. So, and I said, wow. I said, that's unusual. He said, no, I get in a fight every time I go in there. So what would you think? You'd stay
He's
out of
got the, an anger problem?
And well, he did. But you'd also say a reasonable person would stay out of the bar.
Well, yeah.
That bar.
That'd be a good
Unless
start.
You wanted to have a fight.
You're looking for it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
so the fact.
Get your rocks off the, on it.
Yeah. And so we kill and be killed all around the world. It's a continuing cycle. There's no.
Violence.
There's no end to it. And as I said, I mean, there is never even the slightest sense that maybe some of this could be negotiated. Now, let's say that these jihadists are too crazy. Mm-hmm. That's what some people say. They even have any conversation with. Okay. But certainly the Russians, the Chinese, and what, you know, they don't want to have these big arms races. Mm-hmm. Russia does not want to. Russia wants to decrease the missiles that the United States and the nukes, by a third, which brings it down. So they only have 1,000 nuclear missiles rather than 1,500.
Yeah.
So, but they say one of the things you got to do is you can't have these missile shields in Russia, in Poland, in Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be like all of a sudden that, it's not even comparable, but It would be like Russia setting up missile shields in Mexico and Canada.
Right, exactly.
And we would go absolutely bonkers.
But we're this superpower. We just do it.
All right, we are going to go.
Yes.
And but I'm going to leave you with a couple of commercials. I can't remember. What's the name of this book? L, I don't have it written down. L is for Lion, and my website's down. L is for Lion, and it's a butch. It's this gay woman. It's a great, great story. This Butch Bronx Butch something or other memoir. She is over the top.
Well, we like those kind of
people. That's coming up.
Usually.
John Miller, you are the best. Let's see. Here you go. 2012 election turnout, 58.9%. So we didn't even hit 60%. Obama got 65%.
Usually it's around 30%, like especially.
Yeah. Obama obvious. Got 65.9 million votes. Romney, 60.9 million votes. So he got 5 million more votes. And he would have had a lot more if the Republicans hadn't restricted voting.
Yeah.
All right. No question. Back next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Yeah!
The 2013 Riff Rock Girl Search begins soon. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, like many of you, I get these family sort of newsletters once a year around Christmas time, and they tell you everything the family's been doing. And you go, wow, is that all they did all year? You know, that's kind of it. But, and I'm not disparaging anybody. Most of us don't have amazing, exciting, dramatic lives, and most of them could be summed up in just these Christmas newsletters. Of course, you know, some people have such a life that so many things happen to him over a period of time that you can make a book out of it. And my guest has done that. It's a memoir. The book is called L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom Memoir. We could just talk about the title, I'm sure, for almost the entire time. And the author, her memoir, Annie Raquel Lanzalotto, is from the Bronx. She has an incredible life as a performance artist, done any number of shows. She lives in New York. She teaches master classes in solo performance for the Acting Apprentice Company at the Actors Theater of Louisville. And she's the author of a book on poetry and a lot more. We'll get to a lot of that. Annie Raquel Lanzalotto, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, I'm so glad to be here with you, and hello, Detroit.
Well, the first question, L is for Lion. What's that about? What's the title about?
Well, you know, ever since I could spell, I learned how to spell my name because our stoop, you know, the Bronx is full of stoops, which came from the Dutch. When the Dutch built New York, they built these stoops, and we had 11 steps to get into the house. I know your listeners must know what a stoop is.
Well, I was going to say, it's porches here.
No porches.
No porches. It's stoops.
No porch.
That's where you used to bounce your spalding, right?
Yes.
Which is, I had no idea what it was. What's a spalding?
Okay. Well, let's go. A stoop first is a steep, in the Bronx neighborhood I grew up in, it's a steep set of stairs that goes into the house, and that's it. No porch. So when you sit on the steps and you hang out, you actually just sit on a steep, you know, incline of steps. And all our games were played against those steps, or some of our games. Now, the Spalding is what it really is the rejected tennis balls from the Spalding Company.
Oh.
And they would send them these pink inner balls into the urban environment. And we got them in New York. I don't know if any came out to Detroit, if the kids had to play with some kind of ball, but I don't know if these, you know, rejected tennis balls made it to Detroit.
Well, kids today just play video games. They don't know any games.
Well, but years ago. So
yeah.
The
yeah.
Spalding was the heart and soul of play in New York. And like I said, I don't know if it made it to Detroit, but it had a fantastic bounce, and we created over the decades stick ball, stoop ball, box ball. There's a film out called New York Street Games that I'm interviewed in by director Matt Levy, and it's a phenomenal film on the history of street games in New York. And and actually, that you bring up video, you know, it does get into the sedentary lifestyle of play in this generation, and you know, has a political message about that. But anyway, so I learned to spell my name on the stoop. This is where the title comes in. And we had 11 steps, and there's 11 letters in my last name. So as a four-year-old, I'd go up and down the stoop, L-A-N-Z-I-L-L-O-T-T-O. When I got to kindergarten, they left out the middle L. And my whole life in hospitals and schools, The L, I mean, it gets spelled a million ways, as you can imagine, but the L is often left out in the middle in America, not when I'm in Italy. And so as many people do, you say, well, how do you spell your name if you, let's say you're on the phone or you're at a hospital. So L as in luck, A as in antelope, you know, you do these,
sure,
you know, and you either do nautical or you do you know, whatever you do, countries or you do words you like, or you could even get a little risque in what words you give them. But anyway, so after my father passed, he came to me in a dream, and he had a face like Dr. Zhivago, like the big brown eyes and the eyebrows, and he was right up close to me in my dream, and he said, L is for lion.
Wow.
So that became the title.
That's the title of the book by Annie Raquel Lanzalotto. You can go to lisforlion.com, and rather than spelling her last name a lot of times, go to my website, werbe.com, peterwerbe.com, or lisforlion.com, although there's an annielanzalotto.com as well. Now, so this could, way this is shaping up, this is just another one of those happy childhoods in the Bronx or Brooklyn or New York that's so charming to everybody, particularly outside of the New York area. But there's a dark side to L is for Lion as well. Actually, it was pretty disturbing. And tell us some just about what you experienced in your early childhood, what you witnessed, and how that affected you through the rest of your life.
I will. And, you know, I got to say, it's amazing you brought up those Christmas letters, because I get those from from siblings.
Yeah.
And when I get those from siblings, I have an angry response, because as a memoirist, we really, you know, tune in and dig deep and find out things about the patterns of our lives through the generations that really blow your mind. I mean, for example, my father in his late years, the story begins, my father was a Marine in World War II, and he fought in Okinawa and Guadalcanal with the 1st Marine Division. His last years were spent in a mental home that first he went to the violent ward of a Veterans Administration hospital, and then his last years were spent in this home. And one of the things he did, he hung out in the boiler room. That was always his spot. He fixed boilers. He knew everything about boilers. He made coffee by diverting the water out of the copper tubing on the side of the boiler. You know, the man spent his career with boilers and his last years. And I'd sit there with him on an overturned bucket in the basement of this mental home. And he would, you know, stir a little coffee into a cup and just use the boiler water. I mean, you know, that was our life. The story begins with, it's 1968 and I'm at the maple table with my father, the dining room table. And inevitably, the war comes right into that, you know, late 60s kitchen. Now, you can't say he remembered the war. You can't say he told stories about the war. He lived the war. It really never ended. And
it was World War II for him, yet it was in the midst of another American war,
yeah.
Vietnam. And you were how old in 1968? You were sitting at the table.
I was on my way into society, going to Catholic school, and he prepared me for that entrance into society by telling me to look out for kamikaze,
wow,
by telling me to not stay near the windows in the classroom because glass could shatter with a bullet. My brother was in Vietnam, and this triggered my father in ways that I can't really imagine. I mean, I lived it, but what was going on inside him, I'm sure, was just hell all over again.
Essentially, he was experiencing what we call now PTSD, right?
Yes.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, a lot of men on my block had what they called then battle fatigue. Violence was par for the course. It was a daily activity. It wasn't anything alien or strange. Domestic violence was rampant. And, you know, families are casualties of war. I mean, families are uncounted casualties of war. You know, there wasn't any help back then, or he didn't access help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the men in general, well, in my block, did not access help for their trauma from war. You know, either medications or psychological help or support groups, chat rooms, the things we have today. And I urge people to get help.
Sure.
You know, soldiers, now we have a whole new generation of soldiers and families. And there is help out there. So I do list resources on one of my blogs through the website. And, you know, there is a PTSD community and blogs, and there's help. So it's crucial. You know, my father was a brilliant man. And one thing he gave me when I was 8 years old was a flag he captured in Okinawa.
Hmm.
With the whole history of a soldier's family on the flag, named Toshiharu Kotani. And this flag, you know, has been with me my whole life, and I still wrestle with, like, finding survivors of that family. Or, you know, there's Japanese characters written on the flag. My father killed this soldier and captured the flag. But that's what he gave me when I was a little girl, and that's how I went off at 5 years old in 1968 with a brother who went to Da Nang. I was going off to Catholic school, but very much living this not civilian mentality, but this Marine mentality.
Reintroduce you just to make sure people are just joining us. Perhaps my guest is Annie Raquel Lanzalanto. She's written a memoir called Ella is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom Memoir. I'm looking at our clock, and we were talking before the broadcast began, and we were saying that we needed about 10 hours. I'm getting a little worried. What you're saying is the key. In many ways, the description of the interaction with your father, and yet we got to leave time to get everything else in. So your father became abusive towards you as well, and your mother.
Yeah, physically abusive toward my mother. You know, I caught a few falls, but he wasn't physically abusive toward me. Just when I tried to break them up, sometimes I'd, you know, inadvertently get hurt.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole house, it was a culture of violence. So that was, that's what it was.
You then at one point, and this story, by the way, you can't get this out in the telling. You could if you went to one of Annie Raquel's Lanzalanto's performances where she some of this material presents itself. It's in the book, Ella is for Lion. You can go to ellaisforlion.com. Fast forwarding really quickly, this is a happy ending, folks, so stay with it. But suddenly at a young age, you develop cancer. You've had a lot of travails.
Yeah. Well, I'm a long-term survivor, and again, there's help for people out there too who are long-term survivors of cancer and have issues with the effects of treatment. You know, as we know, treatment also wages war on the body. So, there are support groups. If anyone needs tips on that, they could contact me through the website. Because that's where the help is, in the activism amongst survivors. You know, that's where you find out what you need to keep surviving.
Well, what people maybe have missed in the subtitle of Ella's for Lion is an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom memoir. So you came from a situation in which your father was abusive to your mother. You developed cancer and overcame it. And then you began also struggling with questions of sexual identity. And Butch, as people, I thought most people know that, refers to, I don't want to get in trouble.
No, go ahead, give it a try.
You're not setting me up. It's your book. You tell us what it means to you.
But I'm on with the great Peter Wernke. I want to hear.
Yeah, well.
Okay. Well, look, all I know is when I was a kid, my father called me daddy.
Wow.
And the rest just followed from there. I was a tomboy. I loved the nuns in school because they were strong and they didn't wear makeup. And my life, you know, took a pattern of loving women and identifying, you know, with wanting to feel some power in life, which was the men, you know, in my upbringing. The women were beasts of burden, and my identity quickly formed immediately into, you know, with the men, hanging out with the men, talking about what the men talked about, or listening, really just listening. I mean, one of the impetuses for this book is I practically memorized everything my father ever said.
Huh.
And everything at the table. I mean, partly because he repeated what he said a lot over and over. You know, there were these monologues that were repeated through the years, but I was frozen in fear and just, like, memorizing and listening to vigilantly everything around me.
Can you give us an example off the – is it easy? I mean, actually, I should have, yeah, go ahead.
Take water. They could pollute part of the water in one part of the world, but it all washes up right here in the Bronx on Orchard Beach.
Yeah.
All the water's connected. And, baby, sometimes I think these oceans were made of tears. If you look at if all these houses were made of glass, you'd see fighting and kicking and screaming.
And those are your
if you trip on that piece of sidewalk, lay down and call an ambulance. Sue the city. Sue the landlord. Don't move till that ambulance comes. Civilian life, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it.
No, bad words.
Well, civilian life, forget civilian life. Civilian life, everybody sues one another. In the Marines, you can trust one another. And remember, eat with guys you trust. You know, no matter what you eat, it's better to go hungry than eat garbage. But the most important thing is eat with guys you trust.
Well, Annie Raquel Lanzalato, you're channeling almost a man who was abusive to your mother, who suffered from great mental anguish. What feelings rise up in you when that happens? And did you? Well, let me ask that first.
Yeah. Well, I loved my father.
Did you? Okay, that's what I was. I
was the apple of his eye. I felt that anyway. We played pinochle when I was 2-3 years old. He really spent time with me and taught me imagination. You know, we'd sit at the table, he'd give me a blank piece of paper, he'd scribble circles on it, and he'd say, what did you see? What do you see? And he'd, I don't want to say force me, but kind of force me to develop the power to see something in nothing. You know, and he was a man of hard work and honor. He was a war hero, and he was an ice man. He was a strong man. Everyone either feared or respected him and loved him. And he was sick. You know, he had mm-hmm. sickness. He was mentally ill. But he always, you know, when I was in the cancer hospital at Sloan Kettering, he would stay there night and day, sleep in a chair like it was a foxhole. And, you know, he'd say, baby, you got to keep going. And he'd tell me stories from the war, you know. He'd say, Anderson got gunned down beside me, and the Sarge whacked me in the butt with the rifle and said, Lanzi, you got to keep going or you'll be next. Hmm. You know, he tried to inspire me with his Marine experiences to survive. And his life was no picnic. You know, he was as a child, they all were labor. They didn't have childhoods. They worked on the ice truck since they were 7 years old, got pulled out of school. Didn't have educations, didn't have childhoods. So, you know, it was a whole different time, just a very short few decades ago.
Sure. Do you retain an anger at what the war did to him?
Yeah, I mean, I got thrown out of the VA hospital once just for trying to talk to the doctors and just even about... My father died of lung cancer in a VA hospital, and I asked one of the doctors a stupid question. I mean, civilians... and my father would say civilians ask dumb questions, right? You know, mm-hmm. And so I said to the surgeon, why did the Marines issue cigarettes with K rations? Well, my father threw a fit. You know, obviously that was a civilian question, and he threw me out of the hospital. So do I have anger? I don't know. I mean, my father, you know, World War II was a highlight experience for him, even though it destroyed him. What I mean to say is the camaraderie he felt with the fellow Marines was unequaled in civilian life.
Sure.
And the times in war that he describes, he says there's a lot of waiting in war. The times he describes where they were waiting and with each other, I don't think he would have traded for anything in civilian life. He didn't value cars or nice haircuts or, you know, in a sense, he wasn't a man of ego, you know. So, but it did destroy him. Am I angry at the world for war? Yeah, I think war is pretty useless. I'll go with John Lennon on that, and you know.
Yeah. My guest is Annie Raquel Lanzalato. Her book is L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom Memoir. It is published by Excelsior Editions. It's an imprint of the State University of New York Press. You can go to lisforlion.com. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And as I was saying earlier, we're quickly running out of time. We got into that line of discussion by talking about you becoming a butch by seeing that power lay with men and that you spoke to men. At one point you cross-dressed as a man. And were you accepted as a man? Did the men think you were a man?
Well, I cross-dressed in Egypt, and you know, because I wanted to be free. I wanted to be able to sit in a cafe. I wanted to be able to go to the male side of the mosque and experience, you know, what was going on culturally and religiously in Egypt. And, you know, women just can't walk where they want, when they want, or sit in a cafe. It's just, you know, men have freedom. What can I say? And I saw that as a very young girl on that stoop, because it was the boys who played in the middle of the street. You know, the boys who had the stickball game and took off their shirts and played the shirts against the skins, and it wasn't the girls. And I wanted that freedom.
Now, we're going to have to fast forward. Now you're a successful poet and performance artist. You've had any number of presentations of your work. Do they express all of this that is in L is for Lion and what we're talking about? Is that the root of your performance work?
Yeah, I began performing when my seventh grade nun gave me the Gettysburg Address. She said, memorize it.
Wow.
And she started taking me to oratorical competitions. And I got the sense of power that one person could have when they do public speaking. And you could really move people's hearts with words. And so becoming a performance artist and a poet was definitely linked to that early experience. The book, I think, is more comprehensive. I do a lot of solo shows, and they're great fun and moving experiences. The book, you know, is a way that you can experience it quietly on your own. So I'm getting some reader feedback. Particularly, it's interesting, Peter, because not everybody could get out to the theater, right?
Sure.
You know, so I'm getting feedback from people who are housebound with illness or old age, and they're reading the book and saying, this was my experience. I grew up with violence. I grew up in an urban environment. I played in the streets. And they're passing the book on to people saying, if you want to understand something about my life, the violence in my house, read this book. And that's something that I never got in the theater. You know, that's something that when people are isolated in this society, lots of people are isolated. We don't have such a piazza culture where people are communing on a daily basis, know, you know, who's making their coffee or a fresh piece of bread in the morning. People are isolated. And that a book can reach isolated people really is giving me a satisfaction
that's good
that I've never known before.
You know, we have 60 seconds, and here's a big question. Sometimes getting things out relieves a lot of pain. Did the book do that for you?
Yes, the book has its own body, so it's out of my body. And that's a beautiful thing about books. It's a gorgeous blue book with orange lettering. SUNY Press put out a gorgeous book, and it has its own beautiful body, and I'm so happy about that. And, Peter, I love you. Like I said, we need 10 hours.
We could. And there's
we haven't even talked about Virgilia D'Andrea, my favorite anarchist, who finished her speeches, Viva l'anarchismo!
And I was telling you, I knew all these elderly Italian gentlemen back 20 years ago who were in their 80s then, who were these fine gentlemen, but had il ideale. They had the ideal They wanted to create a perfection of humanity through their political beliefs. Well, here's what you're not going to believe. We are completely out of time. We have barely, believe me, folks, scratched the surface of the memoir written by Annie Raquel Lanzalato. You can go to lisforlion.com, and that reflects the title of the book, L is for Lion, an Italian Bronx Butch Freedom Memoir. You go to my website as well. It's Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there'll be a link there as well. Annie, it's been wonderful.
Peter, you're the best. Until next time.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
How do you keep an older car running like new? Just ask a Ford customer.
How are you?
Jackie, tell me why somebody should bring their car here to the Ford dealership for service instead of those other places.
They have wonderful service. I come and make sure I get my oil changed, and when they tell you your tires need to be rotated, you got to get that done as well.
The Works, $39.95 or less, minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details through 3/31/13.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter Werby here with you. Thanks for joining me. I have a friend of mine who has insomnia, and a phrase I hear from her very frequently is that sleep is a wonderful thing. And most of us know somebody that has insomnia. That's pretty widespread throughout our society, and feel badly for people. Most of us who don't have insomnia have had sleepless nights or had issues that have kept us up, and we're sort of aware how distressing it is. But it's way beyond that. And it took a book that I recently received from the University of California Press called Insomniac to really give me a full idea of what it's all about. It's written by Gail Green, and Gail Green is professor of literature and women's studies at Scripps College. That's in Claremont, California. She's published books on Shakespeare, women writers, and scientific issues. And she's most recently published a book, Doris Lessing, The Politics of Change, and another book, The Woman Who Knew Too Much, Alice Stewart and the Secrets of Radiation. She's a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. That's a professional medical society for researchers and clinicians. And she's the patient representative on the board of the American Insomnia Association. We're reaching her at her home near Berkeley, California. Gail Green, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, people that don't have insomnia really do tend to underestimate its effect on people. Has that been your experience?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people take sleep for granted. When it works well, they just don't even notice that it exists. And this has been a real problem because it means that research has not looked at sleep until quite recently. You know, it's the invisible third of life. It, you know, lights out, systems down, what's to talk about. So sleep has been very little studied. This, you know, attitude has gone to the scientific community at large until the middle of the 20th century when they discovered REM sleep and realized how very much is going on in sleep, how our brains are, you know, active and our bodies are replenishing themselves and how important it's the fuel of life. Sleep is the fuel of life. So it's less taken for granted by scientists now, but still taken for granted by the population at large.
Mm-hmm. Mostly people consider it personal misery, but in your book, Insomniac, you list all the other effects it has on one's personal and professional lives. I wonder maybe you could expand on that a little.
Yeah, well, it is ironic that it takes an insomniac to really tell you, you know, how very important this is to your life, because when it doesn't work, I mean, it affects the cognitive functioning. First of all, you don't have your mind. You can't, your attention, your memory, all of those things are, you know, severely impacted. And then your mood is just, people cannot, I've often been asked, are you a cranky person? Because I say somewhere in the book, this is a cranky book. And I said, which me are we talking about? The me with sleep or the me without sleep? You know, I'm fine when I get sleep. When I don't get sleep, yeah, I'm cranky. Yeah, I'm irritable. I'm on the verge of tears or tantrum. But so's everybody, you know. And you know, when you drag sleep loss out over time, then you have a person who really, you know, does become psychologically impaired. The conventional explanation for insomnia is it's depression or anxiety, but people actually get that way when they can't sleep. So they're looking at the consequence of the disorder and you know, saying that it's the cause, which is one of the things I found in the book. I mean, that was one of my strong messages, was that this is not a psychological disorder. This is actually just a physiological consequence of not being able to sleep. We do become psychologically a bit of a mess.
Well, you mentioned the downside to one's cognitive abilities and probably creative abilities, but Gail Green, you're a professor of literature and women's studies. You've published books on Shakespeare, on women's writers, scientific issues. So and you have your 500-page book, Insomniac. So,
my function.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have like what they call high-functioning alcoholics.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I mean, this has been a lifetime of learning how to sort of manage it. It's also been an enormous amount of luck. I'm an academic, which means I get to structure my own hours. I don't have to be functioning at, you know, 8 in the morning. I couldn't have done that. And the people I interviewed a lot of insomniacs for this book, and they were really wrecked by these schedules, you know, the 9 to 5, the 8 to 5 schedules, the really demanding regular, you know, kinds of work schedules that most people have. And plus, if you're a mother, I mean, if you're raising kids, that imposes a regularity of schedule. These are the people I found that were really the most severely impacted by this disorder. And there are so many of us, you know. I thought, I think I started this book with woe is me. Mm-hmm. And then I realized about halfway through, wait a minute, you're one of the lucky ones. You're an academic. You can structure your time. You can stand back and look at this problem. Other people don't get that privilege. They are really ground into this kind of, life in this society is pretty relentless. I mean, in terms mm-hmm. of the, you know, employers need to be more flexible, allow people to do work on their own time. I don't know what you do about getting the kids to school. You know, if you're lucky, you get a cooperative partner. But, I am functioning, but I've been very, very lucky, and it's taken me a lifetime to sort of learn how to do it. And I'm also not adverse to taking a certain amount of medication. And if you try to do it without medication, I think in some ways it's harder.
The book is Insomniac. Gail Green is my guest on the Peter Werby Show, and her website is sleepstarved.org. I'm going to give that more times than I normally do during a broadcast, because insomnia is so widespread that I think probably a lot of you are going to want to go to that site. Actually, this is the first time in a long time that I've interviewed anybody where there was a one-word title without a subtitle. There's also, you know, it's usually Insomniac, the story of how people, do you expect, and has it been so that people, that this really resonated with people, just that this one word on this sort of dark cover that suggests night and has a little quarter moon there?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I expected the press to give me some trouble about that, but they didn't, because it actually did say it all. I mean, what I do in this book is tell the inside story of what it is like to live with this disorder. Other people, there have been many, many, many books on insomnia and sleep, and they tell you they're written by experts, and I often feel that I'm putting experts in quotation marks here, that these guys have never had a sleepless night in their life, you know, and they don't really know what it's like to kind of have to function with it and to have to be on the next day and pretend like it doesn't exist. This is a great invisible disorder, too. I can maybe come back and talk about that, the invisibility of it, which means that people, you know, it's not like you have a pair of crutches or a cast going around. I mean, nobody knows that you've had 2-3 hours of sleep the night before. I haven't had a whole lot of sleep last night. I have to confess this to you. This interview is not the easiest. I wanted to find out what the world looked like to insomniacs, you know, not only myself, but to other insomniacs. So I went around and interviewed a whole lot of them. And as I say, I found out I really was one of the lucky ones. But I also wanted to find out what the science knew about this disorder, and it turns out very little. I mean, that was really a shocking thing about it. Well, it wasn't so shocking, because I'd been getting the same sort of dumb old advice all my life, and I thought, where is the science after 50 years? You know, I've been an insomniac ever since I can remember. My father was a doctor, so he would tell me sort of the conventional, you know, go to bed earlier, go to bed at the same time. You get so wound up. And, you know, when you hear the same advice for 50 years, you begin to think, where is the science? So that's the other question I had, you know, what does the world look like to insomniacs, but also what is the science up to?
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, so it became a lot about the scientific, you know, state of the art on insomnia.
Well, let's do this. I mean, I rarely structure interview and just kind of let them grow, but I have a number of questions. If someone would have said to me, why do so many people that I know have insomnia, I would say, well, it's a product of the modern world. There's so much stress. There's so much noise. There's so much going around in what the Buddhists call our monkey brains, that no wonder that great numbers of people don't sleep or have great trouble sleeping. And I conceived of this as completely a modern phenomena. But maybe you could speak to that, and also tag on to it what you call it a disorder. Maybe and you're a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. So talk about, if you would, it's modernity, or lack of it, actually, and also what's considered to be the physiological or psychological origins of it.
Yeah, there's no question that life today is really not conducive to good rest. I mean, the demands, you know, placed on us, the anxieties, I mean, insomnia is up, you know, since last October, since the kind of economic crash. So it's obviously hooked into modern life. Also, modern life is unforgiving. I mean, if you live in a village, a third world village, there's just more, you don't have to be quite so, you know, functional so early. So there's not so much riding on it. Sleep, there's many more forms that sleep takes in, traditional societies and in, I mean, there's biphasic sleep. I mean, people sleep, you know, some in the siesta cultures is the best known. But there's other forms of it, you know, where sleep just occurs in little pieces here and there and the other. You nap during the day, you're up at night. It's more forgiving. And this, they found that, you know, we probably slept in the past in this way. That sleep in an 8-hour consolidated block is probably a factor of the Industrial Revolution and electricity. I mean, that it, you know, it made us have, you know, have to adhere to factory time rather than sort of natural time. So the modern world, yeah, is very, sleep unfriendly. And there's also this kind of sleep machismo, oh, you don't really need that much sleep. And the really tough ones that get to the top, they don't need sleep at all, you know. So we don't respect sleep. We don't have a kind of, we don't go with our body's needs. So yeah, all of that makes for, I think I would say probably a whole lot more sleep problems than there ever were in the past. Of course, it's difficult to know if that's really the case. But, okay, having said that, there is also enormous variability when it comes to sleep. I mean, some people have stronger sleep systems and some people have weaker sleep systems. That's, you know, just the way some people are, you know, 6'2" and other people are 5'2". I mean, there's just, it's a physiological system. And there are, you know, morning people and evening people and short sleepers and long sleepers and fitful sleepers and deep sleepers. And the science is beginning to understand the genetic basis of these differences in sleepers. In fact, you've got some very interesting scientists right there at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit who are really onto the way the sleep system works. And it's this huge variability, as with any physiological, biological system, you know.
This is physiological. That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, this is physiological. Okay. I mean, there are good sleepers and bad sleepers. And God forbid, you know, if you end up having a weak, fragile system in this society, you know, you put the two together and you really get a population where a third of the people are complaining about insomnia. That's a statistic. It's just huge. You know, I mean, some people are less endowed than others, well endowed than others. I mean, think of it. You know, we know this with the digestive system or the muscular skeletal system or the respiratory system, all of these systems. You know, people who have weak lungs, weak stomachs, you know, who, you know, we're different. We're physiologically different. And so it is with sleep. I mean, and, you know, if you have a fragile sleep system and then you are, you know, in a situation in this society which is demanding, you know, just demanding that you be on and functioning, I mean, you're going to get really kind of mangled by that. And a lot of people do. And this is why I think we have such a huge, you know, I don't think the sleep system has changed in over, you know, the eons. I mean, I think probably there always were fragile and stronger sleepers, but village life was more forgiving. It absorbed eccentricity more easily than our own society does.
Is there more of a, or is there also rather a psychological component? I know that people that have insomnia tell me they're fearful about going to sleep because they know they're not going to sleep.
Oh, yeah. Well, that can develop over time. Yeah, you really do become afraid of the bedroom because, you know, my God, you know, I'm going to have another sleepless night. And there are behavioral methods that can be effective with that, you know, to kind of break that cycle. But even this thing of like, you look at somebody and you say, oh, that person is really stressed, you know, I mean, they ought to get a grip, they ought to, and, you know, often this is a physiological thing. I mean, there are stress systems that are more highly reactive than other stress systems. There are also people who are, you know, just type A, neurotic, crazy, you know, stressed, obsessive people who sleep like stones, who sleep just beautifully. I mean, it has nothing to do with the sleep system. You know, they're just like, I mean, I have several people in my own circle of acquaintance who I'd look at and say, if this person is like, you know, you would think this person would be an insomniac, and they sleep quite well. So that was one of the things that kind of broke that equation of sleep disorder equals psychological disorder. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Hmm. Often no. I mean, more often than one thinks. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I didn't, you know, really wanted to say, bottom line, we're really not crazy, you know. We're differently abled.
Okay. The book is Insomniac. The author is Gail Green. She's my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Her website is sleepstarved.org. Sleepstarved.org. There'll be a link on my website as well. Peter Werbe, that's W-E-R-B-E.com as well. You mentioned that the part of the structure of this book, and we can talk about the other parts as well, because I'm sure there's some people that want to know some suggested solutions or places to go for, but you interviewed a lot of people. How did you find fellow insomniacs did you travel a lot? I mean, it's kind of unusual, so I want to talk to you about not sleeping, but tell us about those.
Yeah, this is a web-enabled book. I mean, I couldn't have done this without the web, you know. I mean, you just, well, I put it, first of all, I ran ads in, you know, kind of pricey places, and got really, really fascinating responses. And then, of course, I would just talk to anybody, you know, on a personal, I mean, I became asleep, you know, I'd accost people in line at the theater, like, so how do you sleep, you know? Or I'd meet somebody who had some kind of interesting tick, like the guy who works on my computer, who's just so tightly wound, and I'd say to him, so how do you sleep, you know, and he turns out sleeps very well, you know, so I just talked to everybody, and then friends of friends and students, I put out a huge thing at my colleges, and I got quite a lot of really, really interesting stuff from students who are not immune to this problem at all. I mean, you know, I mean, there's huge stress, a huge amount of pressure on young people, and they're just like, you know, they're responding as grown-ups do, you know, not sleeping very well. I just got a lot of really heartrending stories of people who, and I still do. I mean, the reader mail I get about this book is just, it leaves me kind of like, because I don't know where to tell people to go. I mean, it's not like I can say, oh, there's this terrific person here, there's this terrific person here. I wish I could. But what I can say to people is do your own research, find your own way. Sleep is highly individual. We're all different in terms of the way we sleep, in the terms of the way we don't sleep. You know, like I, for example, assume that all women would have a hormonal link to insomnia, because I always did. They don't. I mean, some women do and some women do not. So we're all, you know, highly individual. We have to find our own way. The web is a marvelous resource. You find out what works for other people. You try everything. You just simply bring it home and try it. And you may find the key, you know, that unlocks. I mean, I have a whole chapter on this in my book, and I've had people write me about things I haven't even tried in the book because I just haven't been, you know, gotten it together enough to try these, you know, vitamin cocktails and things that actually this, you know, people have found that they've worked. I use books on tape. I mean, when I wake up at night, I tend not to get up and do something else, as the experts tell you you should do, because that totally wakes me up. But I listen to a recorded book, and it often just helps me, you know, get back to sleep. Often does not, but it's a thing that people should know about. There are lots of ways out there, you know, but you have to find out what your problem is. If it is anxiety about the bed place, then you really should try these behavioral modification techniques. You know, troubleshoot your own condition. You yourself have to make yourself an expert in your condition. And there are ways, you know, people have found ways of dealing with it. So that's the hopeful message. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. There are no one-size-fits-all solutions. But there are things that people have found that work.
You know, I wish you'd tell us a little about this column that you wrote for Tara Parker Pope's column called Well, W-E-L-L, in the New York Times. Let me see. Well, it was over a year ago. And you talked about humor. And, you know, that is kind of horrible. I mean, maybe I shouldn't make public confessions, but I almost could feel jokes coming up. Well, it's your book, Insomniac, is 500 pages. You know, you probably had a lot of time to write it. Ha, ha, ha.
Ha, ha, ha.
But you speak to that. I wonder if you could just even kind of, I mean, it certainly immediately raised my sensitivity level. And although you realize I managed to sneak that one in. The little section in your column that you talk about if you say I'm an insomniac and then people say to you, but you know, I go to sleep as soon as my head hits the pillow.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's what I mean. It's the insensitivity to sleep. I mean, it's not. I don't mean people's personal insensitivity, horrible person, but it's a cultural insensitivity to it. You know, it's like, right. I mean, you wouldn't say to somebody, you know, who had some horrible health problem, "Oh, well, that's funny because I can, you know, run the marathon." You know, you wouldn't say that to a person. But if you meet an insomniac, you say, "Oh, my head hits the pillow and I'm out." We're just not. I don't know. We're not cued into sleep. We don't respect it. It's not, you know, productive in our terms, and it's a waste. I mean, it's positively seen as a waste of time. I mean, my students say, you know, "You snooze, you lose. I'll sleep when I'm dead." You know, there's all kinds. I mean, they're working on their sleep machismo. But yeah, the humor is. I mean, that's actually the first line of the book. The first thing to go is your sense of humor. I mean, it's kind of like this tread or this oil that, you know, this sort of lubricant for living that you just don't have when you don't have a night's sleep. And I thought it was just very important to get that across, because people who do have that tread and that lubricant, they don't get it. They just don't see that we're not dealing. It's not a level playing field here. You know.
Let me just expand. In your column, you quote British comedian David Baddiel.
Yes.
And he says, when people say to him, "Well, I can fall asleep right away," he says, "When I see someone in a wheelchair, I don't say, 'Really? Because I can do this,' and hops around the stage on one leg. Hey, look at that."
I thought that was a great one.
Indeed. In many ways, you've already touched on what normally would be the end of an interview, and we're almost at it with Gail Green in her book Insomniac from University of California Press. And that was it. You said that essentially that people had to do their own research. And, I don't know. I mean, do most people have strategies? I mean, personally, you know, without doing research, people say, "Oh, I'll take warm milk," or I, you know, do people develop those, or do you think it really is important to expand their field of information about this? Certainly reading this book, I know who I'm giving it to.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to answer the thing about most people. I mean, people are at all levels, you know, with this in relationship to this problem. There are people who are just raw and what should I do, and I have no handle on it. There are other people who say, "Well, you know, I find that if I get up in the middle of the night and I just do a little bit of yoga or I watch a little TV and I don't get stressed out about it, I can usually, you know, manage and I'll, you know, sleep the next night," or something like that, who've worked out, you know, attitudes about it. There's me that's, you know, I take a little bit of a short-acting sleeping pill for the second part of the night. I can usually get to sleep on my own. That's another difference in the kinds of insomnia, is there's sleep onset where you can't get to sleep, and then there's sleep maintenance where you can't hold, you know, can't continue sleep. I usually can get to sleep, but then I'm awake 2 or 3 or 4 hours a little later. Late night, I nibble off a little piece of a pill and listen to a book on tape, and you know, that way I sort of patch together 6 or 7 hours of sleep. So that's, you know, the way I've found to manage it. You know, this drug cocktail in my chapter 11. So there's just all different, you know, people are at all different stages with it. I mean, and it's just important to realize that many people have gotten a handle on it, and it is possible to live with it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. My guest has been Gail Green, and her book is Insomniac. It's from the University of California Press. They have lots of great titles, as you probably can tell by the number of authors that I interview from that press. It's ucpress.edu, and Gail Green's book, Insomniac, is there. But also, it's posted at sleepstarved.org. The book is there, and a lot of other material about insomnia. And it'll be linked on my site, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E. Gail Green, thank you so much for being on my show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Getting you back to the rock
on the Riff.
Separate my side. I don't.